The new series of This Cultural Life begins with the author Sebastian Foakes.
My father died in 1998, but he had read Birdsong. I said, were you okay with the sort of sex bits? He said, oh no, I love them.
This Cultural Life with me, John Wilson, is available now on BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 4. Good morning. It is 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 25th of August. This is Today with Justin Webb in London and Anna Foster in Salford.
The headlines this morning. Iran has dismissed fresh sanctions announced by the US, saying it has a two-year plan which will result in another defeat for Washington. We'll be hearing from a former colleague of the Treasury Secretary who announced the sanctions and try to understand what it all means for ordinary Iranians.
These sanctions are 100% making life difficult. With the incomes we have, we simply cannot make ends meet. My child is now unhappy with me and asks, what kind of a job is driving a taxi that you cannot earn a sufficient income?
And the government has set out details of the first phase of a scheme to build 300,000 social and affordable homes across England. We'll be talking to the Housing Minister after 8 o'clock.
Also in today's programme, how the feeling of having no one in your corner is making life so hard for children leaving care and what we can do to help with that. Why bus drivers are downing tools because of the sweltering weather.
The only thing you can do is have your cab window open and hope that as you're driving above 20 miles an hour, you're going to get a bit of a breeze through that window. That's about all you can do, actually. You certainly can't have an ice cream.
And can an AI-powered trolley help you with your shopping? We've been on a highly scientific trip to the supermarket to find out.
I've secured the lasagna sheets and I found the barcode. So I'm going to scan it. Scanned. Put it in the trolley and it's, 75p has added to my total.
The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
Iran has warned that US plans to cut off the Iranian economy from the rest of the world will end in another defeat for Washington. Last night, the Trump administration set out fresh sanctions as part of what it called the single greatest financial offensive ever. It said that countries that continued to deal with Tehran would share in its isolation. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent Yulan Nell.
In a defiant response, Iran's finance minister, Ali Madanazida, said sanctions were not new to his country and that it had a two-year plan to deal with the latest ones. It seems they wished to suffer yet another defeat, he told state television. Iran's security chief, Mohsen Rezai, has already warned that Tehran will respond to economic pressure by retaliating against US Gulf allies. He threatened on social media that not a single drop of oil would be exported from the region. The US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said that banks, businesses and countries that dealt with Iran would share its isolation if they refused to cut ties. Iran's largest trading partners include China, Turkey and the United Arab Emirates, which announced last week it was halting all trade and financial transactions with Tehran.
The government has unveiled plans to spend an initial £10 billion building 70,000 social and affordable homes across England as part of a decade-long construction scheme announced last year under Sir Keir Starmer's leadership. Before becoming Prime Minister, Andy Burnham is reported to have said that the entire £39 billion budget of the programme should be spent on council housing. But this first wave of funding aims to ensure 60% of the new properties are available for social rent, in line with the original target. Our correspondent Tara Welsh reports.
Around 8,000 of the 70,000 new homes will be built in Manchester and West Yorkshire. Other regions such as North East England, Liverpool and South Yorkshire will also get a significant share of the funding. £6 billion had already been announced for building in London, where some councils have waiting lists for more than 100 years for a family-sized home. Around 60% of the new homes are expected to be for social rent. Charities have welcomed that, but Shelter says it's not near to the 90,000 social homes a year needed to end homelessness. The Conservatives say the small print of today's announcement shows homes won't have to be delivered until 2039.
A government commissioned report is warning that young adults who leave care in England are 3 to 4 times more likely to die than other people their age. The authors say more needs to be done to prevent the acute loneliness that some vulnerable care leavers experience. Our correspondent Tom Simons reports.
There have been growing concerns in government about what happens to young people in care homes or being fostered when they become adults. A review for the government by the author and broadcaster Ashley John Baptiste, who grew up in care, and a senior social worker, Claire Chamberlain, found many young people leaving care were profoundly isolated, with no one close enough to notice when things go wrong. In response, the Department for Education is increasing funding to give them better support, from £15 million the year before last to £25 million this year. It'll pay for a programme called Staying Close, which provides accommodation and emotional help from someone they know and trust. Often, that's a member of staff at their former children's home.
A trial in the US of a Libyan man accused of building the bomb that blew up an American airliner over Lockerbie 37 years ago has been postponed for a third time. All 259 passengers and crew on board and 11 people on the ground were killed when Pan Am Flight 103 was destroyed in December 1988. BBC Scotland's Home Affairs correspondent David Cowan reports.
The destruction of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie killed 270 people and remains Britain's worst mass murder. A Libyan man in his 70s, Abu Agila Mohamed Massoud Kir Al-Marimi, has denied building the bomb that brought down the plane. His lawyers requested the delay after telling the courts that newly discovered evidence emerged last Friday. That new information has not been made public, but the judge would have been reluctant to call off the trial at the 11th hour, underlining its potential importance to the case. It's understood a new trial date has been set for January next year.
The Metropolitan Police has sent a file of evidence to the Crown Prosecution Service relating to a man in his 80s as part of its investigation into claims of sexual assault against the former owner of Harrods, Mohamed Al-Fayed. The CPS will now decide whether a charge can be made. Mohamed Al-Fayed died 3 years ago at the age of 94, having never faced any charges. An adviser to the Russian government has told the BBC that factories in the UK producing drones for Ukraine could come under attack from what he called unknown sources after Britain agreed to share missile technology with Kyiv. Andy Burnham has dismissed previous threats by the Kremlin as outrageous. But Andrei Fyodorov, a former Russian deputy foreign minister, told BBC Newsnight there could be some visible reaction from Moscow towards the UK.
Maybe some hackers attack from unknown source, not from official level, of course. There might be different political steps, and I cannot exclude 100% that there might be some semi-military, for example.
What does semi-military mean?
For example, something might happen with enterprises, with the factories which are producing drones for Ukraine.
Fire crews in the US state of Nevada say they've brought under control about a quarter of a major wildfire near the city of Reno. The Hawk Fire has destroyed more than 30 homes and burned through more than 15,000 acres. Around 40,000 people remain under warnings to prepare to evacuate.
Thank you. That's 7 minutes past six is the time. Let us have a look at the weather. It comes from Thomas Schaffernacker this morning. Morning, Thomas. Morning, Thomas.
Good morning to you, Justin. Quite mild this morning across most parts of the country, between around 14 and 16 Celsius, although I must admit I was out earlier on and didn't feel like it, but there you go. It is going to be quite mild today, and humid, that is, and it will be like it for the next few days, but we have got showers on the way. And today there will be a few showers affecting parts of southwestern Britain. I think Cornwall, Devon, Somerset, maybe southern parts of Wales could catch a few showers, which is of course welcome. Any rainfall is welcome in this day and age. The rest of the country should be generally dry, and the best of the sunshine will be anywhere from the Scottish coasts. Merseyside will also have some fine weather, the Midlands, East Anglia, and in fact all along the North Sea coast the weather should be fine today with just scattered fair weather clouds. Now, I mentioned it's mild this morning. It will be warm this afternoon, very warm in fact, in London and the southeast. Temperatures should get to about 27 Celsius. 25 in Birmingham is expected, Newcastle at around 19. And then the outlook for the following few days. Well, we've got heavy showers on the way. In fact, they will start to drift into southern parts of the UK through the course of tomorrow. And there could be some flash flooding because the ground's so dry, so hard, that all of that water is just going to run off. And in fact, most of the heavy showers are expected during the course of Thursday. And they'll also be accompanied by some thunder and lightning. And it will stay warm over the next couple of days, mid-20s in the south in particular. That's it.
Thank you, Thomas. 9 minutes past six now. Let's take a first look at the front pages of this morning's papers. UK handed secrets to foil Putin's saboteurs is the headline on the front of the Daily Telegraph this morning. It says that Britain is the first ally to be granted access to Ukrainian battlefield data as part of a plan to train military AI systems. The Financial Times reports that the information draws on millions of observations collected by thousands of cameras and sensors. The Guardian says the data likely includes Russian sabotage attempts against critical Ukrainian infrastructure.
Some papers highlight Andy Burnham's calls for social media platforms to take down videos glorifying dangerous driving. The Sun says the Prime Minister's declared war on joyride videos. Such footage is called sick on the front page of the Express, which notes examples such as cars weaving through traffic at over 100 miles an hour.
The Times has been told that the Prime Minister has shelved plans to put Thames Water into administration following suggestions that the struggling firm could be put into a form of temporary nationalisation. A Whitehall source tells the paper that the idea is not off the table, but that further work is being done before a decision is taken.
The Daily Mail highlights official figures showing a record one in seven people in England being prescribed antidepressants last year. It says 9.1 million patients were given the drugs by the doctors, an increase of more than 15% in 5 years.
According to the Daily Mirror, pregnant women are being taught how to give birth in cars after the temporary closure of their local maternity unit in Barnstaple. The paper reports that expectant mothers face drives of at least an hour and 40 minutes to Exeter due to staff shortages at North Devon District Hospital. The local NHS Trust said there were plans in place to support women in pregnancy, labour and birth.
And Singapore makes the headlines for offering families the equivalent of about £40,000 for each child that they have in an attempt to reverse the country's falling birth rate. According to the FT, the sweetener includes thousands of pounds at birth and a further payment to support the child's further education.
It's 11 minutes past six.
Fire crews in the US state of Nevada are still battling fires that seem to threaten the city itself, the city of Reno. Inside the Reno Sparks Convention Center, hundreds of Hawkfire evacuees are waiting for word on when they can safely go home. John Hanbury is a Reno wildfire evacuee.
The flames were pretty close to my house, and the smoke was really thick, but we have no idea if our house survived or not, so, yeah.
I guess just emotionally, how are you coping right now?
I'm all worried.
I've been talking to Shima Khalil, who is our North America correspondent, and has been telling me what the latest news is about the efforts to contain the fires.
There has been some significant progress when it comes to the Hawk Fire, which has been raging through the Sierra foothills near Reno since Saturday now. It remains at 15,000 hectares, but the significant change is that the containment now has gone from zero to about 27%. So they have contained more than a quarter of that fire. I think the concern remains its proximity to residential areas, the fact that it starts on the hills and then with great speed and ferocity just tumbles down on people's and near people's homes. We know that some residents have been allowed back to their properties, but the general atmosphere is very, very tense. People are still on edge. The National Guard is still being deployed, taking control of evacuated areas. Tens of thousands remain under evacuation orders. But even though the people did return home, those people have been told, if you get that call, if you get that message, be ready to go again. And I think, you know, throughout the day, we've just seen extraordinary pictures, really, these orange walls of flames racing down the hills, coming into people's homes, people driving through smoke, trying really to outrun the fires to get to evacuation centers. And then you see these slopes completely blackened with burned homes and vehicles scattered across the landscape.
And what are the authorities saying about how it started?
The authorities are saying that it started through human activity. And the question that they haven't been able to answer is when exactly it started and how it started. Was it an accident? Was it an act of arson? Did someone deliberately start that? And when one of the officials was pressed in the latest press conference this afternoon, he said, look, up until now, it remains undetermined. But they were very quick to say that it was started by someone, that this was a human act, but they still don't know the motive, if you will, or if this was an accidental fire.
Shama Khalil, thank you.
It's 14 minutes past six. Young people who've left the care system have an early death rate around 3 to 4 times higher than the general population. And a new government-commissioned independent review suggests that that is linked to being left alone, essentially, without the safety net and the support that they need. Tom Simons is our correspondent looking at this. Tom, the idea of this being a cliff edge when young people leave care has been talked about before, but what has this review found?
Well, it was a concern, really, that when young people leave a care home or foster care at the age of 18, that they're more likely, bluntly put, to die. 36% of these 112 deaths in 2025 that have been identified were through suicide. There were 4 deaths through knife crime, 24 drug or alcohol overdoses, intentional or unintentional, 6 in prison when they died. And the concern is, as you say, that there is this care cliff. The review by Ashley John-Baptiste, the broadcaster, and Claire Chamberlain, a senior social worker, found that young people were profoundly isolated when they left care, and most importantly, there was no one who was close enough to them to realise and help when things had gone wrong. For example, they're supposed to have a personal advisor, and some of those were only visiting every 2 months. So those are the concerns, concerns that Josh McAllister, the Children's Minister, was very worried about and decided to commission this review.
Mm. And the concerns, as you say there, Tom, have been identified. Is there any concrete action being taken to actually try and improve things?
So the government has a scheme called Staying Close, which effectively provides somewhere to live and supervision for people when they get to 18 and leave care. And this is going to be increased, so an increase in funding of about £10 million to £25 million for this year, only a commitment to this year, as far as I can tell. And they also have the Children, Wellbeing and Schools Act, and that means that more public bodies are going to have to become what are known as corporate parents, meaning that the NHS, Job Centre, prisons, probation, have to think carefully about what care leavers need when they design their services. And that means, for example, setting out how they're going to look after some of these young people when they leave care.
Thank you, Tom. Tom Simons there. And Ashley John-Baptiste, who Tom mentioned, one of the co-chairs of this report, who's spoken very widely about his own experience of care and leaving care, will tell us a bit more about those findings on the programme just before eight.
70 minutes past six is the time. Now, investment in Britain's digital infrastructure may be back around levels last seen during the dot-com boom. With more on that and the rest of the business news, Leanna Byrne. Morning, Leanna.
Good morning. Thanks, Justin. And morning to you, Anna, as well. So that's according to new estimates from the Office for National Statistics. The new estimates have broadened the definition of digital infrastructure investment to include data centres and artificial intelligence, would now put the figure for 2025 at £11.2 billion. But that huge demand for AI infrastructure is having knock-on effects elsewhere in the technology industry, particularly on the price of memory chips. Joining us now is Ebden Upton, Chief Executive of Raspberry Pi, the British company that makes credit card-sized computers. Good morning.
Good morning.
So how significant are the cost increases for you? Can you explain that connection for us?
We're looking at an enormous increase in the price of various sorts of memory technology, particularly volatile memory, roughly a factor of 10 over the last 18 months. Taking us back over the long run, memory prices, they've come down. It's a 50-year downwards curve. But what this has really done, this has taken us back to about the same price we were paying for memory when we launched the very first Raspberry Pi in 2012.
Mm. How do you navigate those costs?
In the end, I think, you know, like most technology companies, we went through a period of attempting to shield our customers from these price increases. But sort of starting at the beginning of this year, we've had to now put through a phased series of price increases to our product, really in order to recoup some of those input cost increases.
Mm. Raspberry Pi, it is built on its reputation around making computing affordable, isn't it? So at what point did those increases start threatening that position?
I think as long as we put a lot of effort, and we've done, as I say, we've done several rounds of price increases, so we've had an opportunity to, I guess, finesse how we've done this over time. I think the important thing for us is that the price increases are fair. What we've been doing is passing through, we'd call it unmargined pass-through of price increases. So if our DRAM price increases by $50, we increase the price of our product by $50. I think that's probably the fairest way to to treat our customers. I think the advantage, we had there was a previous semiconductor shortage in the aftermath of COVID, and that affected what we call logic chips. The interesting thing about this time around, memory chips are a commodity. There is a pretty well-defined, publicly available price for memory chips. And so our customers are able to look at the price increases we've put through and benchmark them against those that kind of indexed price and get some sort of notion that we aren't using this as an opportunity to drive up profits.
So how long do you predict this to continue to happen, that you're going to have to keep increasing prices?
These cycles have been with us for the entire history of the memory industry. And this is, while this is a large cycle, it is in the end just another cycle. And the thing that brings cycles, memory cycles, to an end is the investment that the DRAM vendors make, the memory vendors make, in fabrication capacity. Now, the increase in fabrication, and every time you have a cycle, the excess profit that's made tends to get reinvested in production capacity. That will come through in 2028. So we're expecting, I think we've gone from a phase of rapidly increasing prices over the last year to a place where I think prices are high but stable. I think we'll be in that regime for the next, let's say, 12 to 18 months. And I think we'll see some serious relief in 2028. There are things that could happen in 2027, particularly if there's any kind of pullback in the scale of AI investment by the hyperscalers. There are things that could happen in 2027, which would affect that. But I think really we are kind of hunkering down now and expecting that this regime will continue for at least another year.
It's interesting. Last month, the chief executive of the semiconductor manufacturer SK Hynix said that demand for memory will continue to exceed the company's ability to produce well into the next decade. So, but you're a lot more optimistic. Why is that?
I think it's this time it's different. I mean, one of the interesting things about any of these cycles in most industries, but certainly the semiconductor industry, is when you're in the middle of them, people tell themselves stories about how this time it's different, about how this time this isn't a cycle. This is a durable change to the terms of play in the industry. And then it always said, I mean, I remember in 2022, middle of 2022, at the bottom of the last shortage of the logic shortage, nobody believed they'd ever be able to buy logic chips again freely in the market. So I think that this is just the nature of the business that we're in. And we're certainly at that point in the cycle where people are wondering, is it a cycle or has something changed forever?
All right. Thank you so much. Ebden Upton, Chief Executive of Raspberry Pi, the British company that makes credit card sized computers. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, with me now is George Gomper, Fund Manager at Polar Capital. Good morning, George.
Good morning.
Now, the Confederation of British Industry, that's one of the UK's main business lobbying organisations, it's calling the government to cut the taxes businesses pay for employing people. And it's arguing that rising costs are making firms think twice about hiring and particularly hurting younger workers. So does the maths add up there for you, George? Are business costs directly hampering job opportunities for young people?
Yes, very sadly. If we look at the data, we can see that basically unemployment has sort of gone up almost every single month in since Rachel Reeves' first budget, where she hiked the NI hike. The sad truth now is that UK youth unemployment at 16% has just overtaken the EU, and that's the first time I can ever remember that. I think it's a pretty awful backdrop. It's been a big burden on business. It's been the cost of employing people, but also the risk as well, because the Employment Rights Act made it riskier for companies to take on hiring, and the impact has been higher unemployment.
But at the same time, that could cost the Treasury billions, and given the pressure already on public finances, I could add to it. And interestingly, front page of the Times, Andy Burnham didn't rule out tax increases in the next budget.
Look, I'm sure that the government will try and find ways to tax. Well, we've had two record taxing budgets. I'm sure they'll go again. But youth unemployment is really pernicious. And when it gets started, the impact of people not being able to get their first jobs has longer term scarring opportunities on the economy. And of course, the government spends $1.3 trillion a year. There are many other levers they could pull to balance the books should they wish. They don't always have to keep putting through record tax hikes.
Also, front page of the Times is reporting that Burnham has shelved plans to put Thames Water into special administration. It says officials are concerned about the taxpayer cost and legal difficulties. George, another test from the government when it comes to financial reality of things?
It would cost a lot of money. Obviously, we also know from the fact that there are several of the water authorities in public ownership that don't do any better than the private ones, and some accounts they do worse. So it would be a cost. I think it's just the reality, real politique of coming into power and looking at what the numbers mean that he's probably had to back off that policy objective.
Talk about gold. It's climbing again. It's hitting its highest level since May after a fairly quiet few months. So where are we this morning and how close are we getting to those kind of extraordinary record highs that we saw at the start of the year, really?
Well, there's a few things going on. They're all a bit interlinked. The first is sort of general fear about the dollar again. And we saw Bessent's policy announcement for sort of buying long bonds. And that's put fear in the market's mind about what it's going to mean for dollar and dollar debasement, as it's known. So the falling value of dollar in other terms. You've seen very big central bank buying over the last couple of years. And I think that's probably likely to continue against that policy. And of course, at time of heightened geopolitics, high inflation, you've just been talking about high taxations. Gold is seen as a safe haven asset. And I think it's probably sort of, it's still got that allure for many investors.
What would stop the rally? Higher interests? Interest rates?
Yeah, gold yields naught. So that tends to be the thing that chokes it off. And that's certainly what's hurt that run, that strong run it had earlier in the year when we saw this, inflation expectations lead to sort of the expectation of higher interest rates that choked it off. So that it could be that, or it could be, a general feeling of, better sentiment around the economy and people want to put money into more productive assets.
All right. George Copper, fund manager at Polar Capital, thank you so much for joining us. Now, sticking with commodities, the UK is on course for its worst cereal harvest since records began in 1984, while grain prices are also rising, adding to the pressure on animal feed. That's according to the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit. Joining us is Sheila Hancock, the chief executive of the dairy co-op First Milk, which is owned by around 700 farmers. Sheila, good morning.
Good morning.
So what does this actually look like on the ground for your farmers? Are they already having to pay more for feed, or is the problem that drought has left them short of their own winter supplies?
Yes, thank you. It's a combination. I think this rising feed cost is the latest in a line of challenges for dairy farmers. It sort of comes in the back of a significant decrease in milk prices at the end of last year. Then we have a geopolitical inflation with fuel and fertilizer in the spring. The drought has been significant. It's very regional, of course. So in the south and the Midlands and Wales, it's been very extreme. Scotland in the north, less so. But yeah, the feed costs have just added to the challenges and created a really challenging situation across for farmers. As a business, actually, we could see some of this climate volatility potentially and market volatility having an impact. Mm. And we launched the largest regenerative farming program across the UK, which was really there to help farmers build resilience into their farming systems. We have had, some really good progress. That also helps reduce reliance on things like purchased feeds and fertilizers. Progress has been good, but it has probably delayed some of these impacts. But the cumulative impact of what we're seeing now is very significant and posing challenges.
Sheila, First Milk is actually increasing what it pays farmers by 2 pence a litre from September. Does that materially change things, or are farmers still producing milk at a loss?
I think the market downturn last year was very significant. Milk prices fell by 30% or more. So we're coming back from the bottom of a cycle in the market cycles. We've actually increased by about 4.5 pence already this year since the spring. But milk prices are being completely eroded at this stage by these drought. For those in those parts of the countries affected most, which is in the, as I mentioned, the South and Midlands and Wales, pastures have been decimated, so they're having to bring forward feeding costs, and forages that they have already conserved for the winter is starting to be fed. So yeah, milk prices have moved, which is encouraging, but we need to get much further increases, I think, to be able to offset what we're seeing.
Okay, Sheila Hancock, thank you so much. Chief Executive of the Dairy Co-op First Milk. Thank you, Leanna. It's 28 minutes past six now. Hugh is here with the sport. Morning.
Good morning to you, Anna. They might not have selected him for the team anyway, but England will play Pakistan at Lord's this week without Brydon Carse, the latest cricketer to face a disciplinary investigation after a night out. The bowler was seen has been removed from the squad for the second test, pending the cricket regulators' inquiries. He was only in Derby at the weekend because he'd been released ahead of the first game against Pakistan and was arrested briefly during celebrations after a county championship win for Durham, with pictures showing him in handcuffs. Now, Carse is the eighth centrally contracted England player to be involved in or present at a late night drinking incident in the last 10 months. So former wicketkeeper Matt Prior says someone might need to be read the Riot Act.
If you are caught or there is another incident which you're involved in, you lose your central contract straight away. Something like that might make them think, oh, hang on a minute, what's at risk here? Because if the pull of representing England and being a role model isn't enough, then I imagine losing your central contract probably would be.
Now, with all the talk of how the World Cup had a knock-on effect on the first weekend of the Premier League, proof perhaps in another way through someone who had the summer off. Cole Palmer would have been in many people's England squads. He seemed rejuvenated as he made one and scored what proved to be the winner in Chelsea's 3-2 victory at Fulham last night. His new boss, Xavi Alonso, was impressed.
I have really enjoyed his performance. He has played with responsibility, with maturity, but as well with freedom. That's very important for me, that we get the best from Cole when he takes this role, but he feels the flow of the where he has to be involved in different positions. So happy for him, and we want to have a good team. We need a great Cole.
There won't be a rematch of the women's European 800 metres final at the Diamond League in Zurich this week after Keely Hodgkinson withdrew from the event, claiming her body is not quite ready. The Olympic champion was beaten by Switzerland's Audrey Wero in Birmingham, while the Commonwealth gold medalist Georgia Hunter-Bell is also in a very high-quality field. And Heather Watson is one of five British players who made it through the first round of qualifying for the US Open as she attempts to make the main draw in New York. For the first time in 5 years, she'll need to win two more matches to get there. While at 7:25 this morning, we'll be looking ahead to the star-studded mixed doubles event at Flushing Meadows.
Thank you for that. Let us turn to what is coming up later in the week.
On BBC Radio 4.
Two hijacked passenger aircraft were deliberately crashed into the twin towers of the World Trade Center.
25 years since the deadliest terror attack the world has seen. Why are grieving families still fighting for answers?
Saudi Arabia was considered an ally of the United States.
When the trail led to the consulate, it was disturbing.
And how might a man suspected of aiding the hijackers shed light on government secrets?
He said your government is lying when they tell you there was no state sponsors of this attack.
A 9/11 story with me, Jane McMullen, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, next Monday to Friday at 1:45.
28 minutes to 7 now. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb in London and Anna Foster in Salford. And Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
The Iranian finance minister has accused the United States of launching a campaign of economic terrorism after it announced plans for sanctions against organizations and countries that are still trading with Iran. The Trump administration called it the single greatest financial offensive ever and said anyone that continued to deal with Tehran would share in its isolation. The government has set out plans to spend £10 billion on building more than 70,000 social and affordable homes across England. The project is the first stage of a wider £39 billion scheme previously announced by the former Prime Minister Keir Starmer. The Conservatives have warned that the new homes won't have to be delivered until 2039. A government-commissioned report has warned that young adults who leave care in England are 3 to 4 times more likely to die than other people their age. The authors say more needs to be done to prevent the acute loneliness that some vulnerable care leavers experience. The Department for Education is increasing funding to provide better support. A judge in the United States has agreed to delay the trial of a Libyan man accused of building the bomb that blew up an American airliner over Lockerbie 37 years ago. 270 people were killed when Pan Am Flight 103 was destroyed in December 1988. The delay was requested by the suspect's defence team, which said new evidence had emerged in the case. The Metropolitan Police has sent a file of evidence to the Crown Prosecution Service relating to a man in his 80s as part of its investigation into claims of sexual assault against the former owner of Harrods, Mohammed Al-Fayed. The CPS will now decide whether a charge can be made. Mohammed Al-Fayed died 3 years ago at the age of 94, having never faced any charges. An advisor to President Putin has suggested British factories producing weapons for Ukraine could come under attack after Andy Burnham agreed to share missile plans with Kyiv. Andrei Fyodorov told the BBC that he could not exclude what he called semi-military action.
Thank you, Jane. It's 26 minutes to seven. The US has announced, as you were hearing there, a new raft of economic sanctions against Iran. They've been described by the Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, as the greatest financial offensive ever. Yolande Nell is our Middle East correspondent. Yolande, it's fair to say that the aim by the US and Israel of toppling the regime in Iran didn't work through military action. Now they're looking at economic ways to do this. What is being mooted?
So Donald Trump has already called this economic warfare and isolation on an unprecedented scale. And the US Treasury says it's mapped out Iran's revenue networks. It's looking at its most vital lifelines, these five sectors: digital assets, technology, gold, aviation and shipping. And it's put all these sectors on notice. It's also 60 entities and individuals and vessels have been named that it says enable the Iranian regime to procure illicit nuclear and missile technology, to conduct its cyber operations and generate oil revenue. And Washington has been pressing China, which is Iran's top oil buyer. It didn't mention it by name here. Scott Bessent said no one is above this. But there's a lot of skepticism in the US media about whether Washington will impose any serious penalties on China, because Beijing's already saying that coercion tactics don't work. Xi Jinping is due to visit Washington next month. The United Arab Emirates, another important trading partner of Iran, though, has already said last week that it's stopping all trade with Iran. That came hours after a call between the leader of the Emirates, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, and President Trump. And it's said that President Trump is now calling other world leaders to try to sort of stop their interactions with Iran. So that's where things stand at the moment.
Yeah. What is the likely effect going to be, Yolande, particularly given that Iran's response to this is we've been preparing for it, not a problem?
That's right. I mean, already Western sanctions have squeezed Iran, haven't they, for years? And the economy is already in free fall, really. I was watching how Iran's finance minister was reacting to this, and you know, he appeared on state television kind of calm and smiling sometimes. He said they've made every effort to test the resolve of the Iranian people and they failed every time. The government has this two-year plan, it's ready for these developments. A lot of emphasis being put in other Iranian statements on how the Iranian people are being made to suffer by the enemy. This is economic terrorism, they're saying. And Iran's hardline security chief has already come out with a sort of more defiant response, sort of menacingly vowing to prevent a single drop of oil from leaving the region, threatening to strike the interests of Iran's oil-rich Arab neighbors if they join US efforts. Now, there is still some diplomacy going on in the background here. Pakistan, which has been a key mediator, the head of its military, the interior minister, held a day of talks with Iranian leaders and put out a statement saying this was about preventing further escalation and reopening the Strait of Hormuz. Oman's foreign minister is due in Tehran today to talk about the Strait of Hormuz, but I just don't think that at the moment that's going to be enough to stop Donald Trump from pursuing this, you know, new or renewed economic path.
Yolande Nell, our Middle East correspondent. Thank you.
23 minutes to seven is the time. Councils are going to get building again. Councils around England. That is the government's plan. Andy Burnham also saying that he might go to the United Nations annual meeting next month in New York. Let's talk to Jack Fenwick, our political correspondent, who's on the line, starting with the councils. Jack. I mean, councils are already meant to be building, aren't they? Or at least social housing is meant to be being built. Is the relevance of today's announcement that it's councils rather than housing associations?
That is one of the things part of this announcement. The previous government said that there'd be this £39 billion plan. We've had details of the first £10 billion of that. Funding's been granted to Greater Manchester, the West Midlands, West Yorkshire, South Yorkshire, North East England, Liverpool and London. Now, we're told that is going to lead to 70,000 social and affordable homes. As you say, councils will be able to bid for some of those rather than it just being housing associations. We know Andy Burnham talks a lot about council house building. Now, he's previously suggested that all of that £39 billion should be spent on social rent properties. Well, actually, it looks like it's more like 60% of it going on social rent. That's a type of housing that's more heavily subsidised. So there have been some accusations of a bit of a climb down. The Conservatives say that because social rent is more expensive for the taxpayer, they believe this programme will actually lead to fewer homes than previous similar programmes.
OK. And on the plans to go to New York for the General Assembly of the United Nations, I mean, it's not exactly a firm plan to go, is it, or even to see Donald Trump, but that seems now to be in the offing.
Yeah, we're told by Andy Burnham that it's likely he will go to the UN meeting in September. Of course, he was in Ukraine yesterday. He said that leaving Ukraine, he was quite clear what he needed to do in the next few weeks. Well, now he's talking about going to the UN. I think that is code for him and other European leaders to, in effect, lobby the US president on Ukraine's defence needs. Andy Burnham clearly trying to make it clear to President Zelensky that while the UK's Prime Minister has changed, the UK's support for Ukraine has not.
Jack Fenwick, thank you.
20 to 7, police on Teesside have been questioning 12 people as they investigate organised crime after the car crash which killed two police officers on the A66 on Saturday morning. Philippa Goyma is a reporter for the BBC in the northeastern Cumbria. Philippa, just tell us a bit more about these arrests and what it is that police have been looking into.
Well, Anna, the 12 people that have been arrested are aged between 19 and 61. And what we know this morning is that out of those 12, one person has been charged. Five people have been released on bail and the others remain in custody for police questioning. We know that they've been arrested for offences ranging from possession of a firearm to participating in the activities of a criminal group. And the police told us that there were a number of incidents that happened on late Friday night into early Saturday morning, that they had a number of reports of two cars driving dangerously. One car, a Volvo, was witnessed ramming properties in the Middlesbrough area. And the other car, which is the Volkswagen Passat, that is the car that ended up being involved in that fatal collision, the police say that it is believed that that car is associated with the activities of the Volvo. And that is what led to the police pursuit, which saw the Passat drive the wrong way down the A66, resulting in the fatal collision that claimed seven lives.
And some of the background to that, Philippa, that you were just describing there, we've seen a huge outpouring of support for the families of those two police officers who were killed, but also some real tensions in the community as well.
That's right, Anna. So there's a lot of support for the two police officers, PC Matthew Blades and PC Tom Clough. A fundraising page that was set up by Cleveland Police Federation has now raised more than £750,000. That money will be divided equally between their two families. And in terms of tensions, I would say that was primarily online tensions. So there's a lot of comments on social media criticising the occupants of the Volkswagen Passat and blaming them for the incident that happened on the early hours of Saturday morning that claimed the lives of the two police officers. But at the same time, there is pushback from the family and the friends of those in the Passat, because we have to remember that even if their actions did lead to the deaths of all seven people, they do still have mothers, families and friends who cared about them. But you are right, there is tension here, although I would say it was primarily online in the comments.
Philippa Goyma in Middlesbrough this morning for us. Thank you.
18 minutes to 7. What chance is there of charges being brought against people who helped Mohammed Al-Fayed allegedly assault women and girls when he was the owner of Harrods? A file of evidence has been passed, we are told, to the Crime Prosecution Service. Let's talk to Ellie Price, our news correspondent, who's been following this. What do we know about what this file contains, Ellie?
Well, good morning, Justin. The Met confirmed that the file they've sent to the Crown Prosecution Service relates to one suspect, a man in his 80s, and they're looking at two indecent assaults on two women in London. Now, it's of course up to the CPS to decide whether they've got enough evidence to make that charge, but clearly the Met Police think there is now enough evidence. Of course, it's now nearly 2 years since that BBC documentary first outlined just some of the allegations of rape and sexual assault against the former Harrods boss. And then, of course, since then, hundreds more women came forward. The Met Police then launched that investigation. They called it Operation Corn Poppy. And it's been nearly 2 years since the launch of that. And obviously this now seems to be, survivors see it, the closest thing to that first step towards justice.
And if there is a charge brought, it seems likely, does it, that it's aiding and abetting. It's not a sexual assault necessarily conducted by this person. This is aiding and abetting Mohammed Al-Fayed, who is, of course, dead.
Well, interesting. It'd be interesting to see exactly what it is, if indeed it goes ahead. As I say, the details that we were given was that it relates to a man in his 80s looking at those two indecent assaults, not quite exactly, you know, what part he played in those. But as you say, there have now been, the Met says, seven people who've been interviewed under caution as part of their investigation. And they've been questioned on a variety of offences, which include aiding and abetting rape and sexual assault, assisting in the commission of sexual offences, and human trafficking, and that being quite a crucial part of it. Because, of course, Mohammed Al-Fayed died 3 years ago, almost to the day. At 94, he never faced any charges. But clearly some of the survivors say that it wasn't just him who was involved in all of this, that this was a network that was, in effect, a human trafficking network, that his alleged crimes were enabled by a number of people within that network. So obviously it's those people that they're clear that they want to see justice from. And in fact, I did speak to a number of survivors last night following this news. The Justice for Fayed and Harrods Survivors Group told me, and I think this really speaks to how they feel, a number of survivors, that they felt they'd spent decades being told that too much time had passed and nothing could be done, and that this development showed the passage of time does not put accountability beyond reach.
Ellie Price, thank you.
It's 6:45. China's ever-evolving robots sing, they dance, they even run marathons. But the real robotic revolution is taking place in the country's industrial heartlands. China has more robots working in its factories than the rest of the world combined. The country spent hundreds of billions of pounds to transform its workforce like that, and President Xi has made it an economic priority. But what impact will this huge shift have? And does it ultimately mean that robots are coming for all of our jobs? Our China correspondent Laura Bicker reports.
Chinese factories echo with a rhythm created by both man and machine. There are even robots to transport goods around the building, and they don't stop talking. I'm not sure if you can hear clearly behind me, but that is the sound of the swirling, twirling movement of a robot arm. These robot arms need human hands. They drill, they check. But some of this human workforce could soon be replaced. Engineers are creating a new human-sized robot.
I think he needs a smile.
Needs a smile?
Yeah.
For now, its hands can only do basic tasks. But Peng Kai from CRP Technology has ambitious plans.
2 or 3 years later, the robot can do anything.
Really? In 2 or 3 years, it can do anything. Is this the workforce of the future?
In the future, we can use robots to make robots.
Machines can work 24 hours a day and don't ask for a pay rise. We were offered a tour of Leap Motors, a leading electric vehicle maker in Hangzhou.
So in between each stage of the factory, they have to blow dry us clean, make sure we're not carrying any dust.
The hum and the roar you hear is a so-called dark factory. Car parts are lifted in the air, turned, polished and welded with barely a human in sight. Only a few engineers are here to check things are okay. 90 seconds. I'm told parts of the car can be welded together in just 90 seconds. There are more robots working in China than the rest of the world combined. And as you walk along the length of this production line, you can see there's a robot for every single task. They're pivoting, grabbing, spraying, and some are simply just shifting the car part from one area to the next. It's efficient and it's continuous. But behind the scenes, there are still a row of workers helping to do the final touches.
But for how long? Sao Li is vice president of Leap Motors.
Some of our workstations are already fully automated and require no human involvement. I think the day that all cars in China are made by robots will come very quickly.
China needs robots as its workforce is getting older. By 2030, around a third of the population will be over 60. But the speed of this transition is key. Around 120 million people still work in manufacturing. If China moves too quickly, job losses could follow. The school bell ushers a new generation of robot engineers to class. There are 7,000 students at Hangzhou Technician Institute, and they come here from the age of 15. They learn how to work in leading Chinese industries, from aeronautics to processing rare earth minerals. Two of the class are trying to reboot a robot arm alongside teacher Chen Tianyu.
Some students will ask me, "Sir, teacher, one day what will happen?" I say, "I don't know. The technology is changed so fast. I don't know what will happen in tomorrow, even next second. I think the change is so fast. Maybe I take a snap, the world changes."
So the robots are coming. President Xi is betting on this new technology to power his country's next economic transformation. What's still unclear is whether they'll make life easier or more prosperous for people, rather than simply replacing them.
It's our China correspondent Laura Bicker reporting. It's 10 to 7.
And we'll have more on the rise of China's power and what we should be doing about it after 8:30. Now, in the US, the trial of Lindsay Clancy is coming to a close. She's the mother who killed her three children. Her defence is saying she killed them while suffering from postpartum psychosis, as I've been hearing from Anna Fagey, the BBC News correspondent who's been following the trial in Boston.
Back in January of 2023, Lindsay Clancy, a Massachusetts mom of three children, killed her three children in their home. She also, at that time, tried to kill herself, but she ended up surviving. And what's at stake right now is three charges of first-degree murder. The prosecution is alleging that Clancy made a calculated choice to kill her children, while the defense is saying that she did so because she was suffering from postpartum psychosis.
And that defense that she's offering has attracted huge attention, hasn't it? Really right around the world.
That's right, yeah. I think that's honestly the reason why we're talking about the case today. Postpartum psychosis is a pretty rare postpartum side effect, about 1 in 1,000 moms face. Basically, you can experience a mixture of mania, depression, or just one of those two, and you endure some kind of psychotic symptoms. So you could be hearing voices, or you could be imagining people in front of you. And the defense is saying that Clancy experienced that, and that is why she killed her three children. They're not disputing that she did kill them, just the reasoning behind that.
So it goes to the jury now to decide?
We're waiting for closing arguments to wrap up this week, and then it will go to the jury. That's right.
And what is the sense that you have, and indeed that others who've been watching this trial have, of how it went, of how successful the cases were that were made by each side?
I think in terms of the education of what postpartum psychosis is, which I think the defense really tried to do, I think they were pretty successful in that. We've had people talking about this illness that was not really on the map for most Americans before the case started. I think that was they've made a strong case for that. I think it's just hard for some folks to grapple with the fact that she ultimately did kill her children. And deciphering whether or not there was intent is going to be a tough one for the jury.
And what happens to her if she's found guilty?
She'll be sentenced to life in state prison without parole if she's found guilty.
And obviously, either way, in and outside the courthouse, there will be a huge reaction.
Yeah, that's right. We've seen growing support for Clancy outside the courthouse. There's been women gathering, wearing pink, trying to support, to show their support for her. And then, of course, we see this more online. There's been people who are strongly condemning what she did and hoping to see that she's found guilty.
Anna Fagey, thank you.
It's 7 minutes to seven now. For the first time, women who miss their screening appointments for cervical cancer will be given at-home testing kits that they can use themselves by the NHS. Over the next year, 4 million will be offered, and it will hopefully fill what is quite a sizeable testing gap. Figures show around a third of women who are eligible haven't taken up the offer of screening recently. Fiona Osgood joins us, Head of Health Information at Cancer Research UK. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's a tricky one, this, isn't it? Because it's so very important, that screening, and we know it is, but people can find it physically and emotionally uncomfortable, which, as the figures show, can sometimes make them avoid it.
Absolutely. So we know exactly, like you say, screening is so important. It's a really powerful tool that can help us prevent cervical cancer and save lives. But exactly as you say, we know it isn't easy for everyone to take part in screening. There can be lots of reasons why people might not be able to take part. You know, people might have found it painful in the past. People might have practical barriers in terms of getting time off work to attend appointments, things like that. And the hope is that this at-home HPV self-testing will help make that kind of first step into the screening program much easier for eligible women who haven't been able to take up their invite.
For somebody who maybe has been before and is wondering how it will work at home, because it's quite a specific procedure and it would be one that you might think is difficult to do yourself. So how would that work?
Yeah, I think something that's really important to say is that for someone who has been before, who, you know, maybe hasn't faced those barriers to attending in person, it's really important to say that actually the best way to take part in cervical screening is still that routine in clinic and kind of going to a GP, making an appointment, or going to a sexual health clinic and making an appointment as you would normally do. And that's because the sample being taken is a sample of the cervical cells itself, whereas the at-home test is just using a swab. So it's slightly different. It's more just testing if there is HPV. It's not getting a specific reading from your cervix, because like you say, that would be much more difficult for someone to do at home. So it's just kind of a vaginal swab that you do yourself, and it's just testing for HPV. And that's great and a much better option if you weren't attending cervical screening in the first place. But if you were kind of going into a GP surgery, into those clinical settings for cervical cancer screening, it's much more important that you kind of continue to take part in that way, and you'll be continued to be invited in that way.
Yeah, I see what you mean. So it's like a halfway step. It's better than nothing, but it's not as good as going to the GP and getting the test. What I find interesting about this as well, and we did a story not too long ago about the fact that HPV vaccination has made such a huge difference to younger women when it comes to cervical cancer rates, to the extent that it's almost eradicating it in younger women. But it looks like the uptake of that vaccination is dropping a little now.
So we have seen since COVID, the vaccination rates have kind of stalled slightly. And I think that's largely down to practical reasons. It's a vaccine that's delivered through the school system. People are immunized kind of between the ages of 11 and 13. We are still seeing, you know, over 70% of children, which is both boys and girls, are vaccinated. They're receiving their vaccine at school, which is great. But as you say, you know, HPV is the primary cause of cervical cancer. It's also linked to quite a lot of other types of cancer as well, which is why we vaccinate boys too. So we do want to see, you know, as many people as possible take that up. And I think that is partly those practical barriers to kind of getting screened. But for anyone listening who maybe has missed their HPV vaccination, it is really important to say you can get that as a catch up. So if you missed it in school and for whatever reason, you know, if you're ill and off school that day, you can go to a GP up to the age of 25 and be given that vaccination. So, you know, it's not a kind of one chance only thing, but it really sort of shows the impact of science, you know, both cervical screening and the developments we're seeing today and the HPV vaccination have come from our better understanding of what causes cervical cancer and how we can then prevent it from happening in the first place through vaccination and also through screening.
Yeah. Fiona Osgood, thanks for joining us, Head of Health Information at Cancer Research UK.
I'm David Dimbleby. I've reported on America for decades.
The United States, whatever our faults may be, is the hope of the world.
America seen as the head of the free world. And yet today, that idea is in crisis.
From the History Podcast, Invisible Hands, the American Century.
The story of how the United States became a superpower at the head of a new global order. And the invisible hands that guided it.
Listen first on BBC Sounds.
Let's check the weather. Here's Thomas. Morning.
Good morning to you, Anna. It's looking pretty good, I think, for most of us today. Now, at the moment, we have a few showers in the very far northeast of England, also around the borders of Scotland, and one or two showers affecting Cornwall and Devon. But elsewhere, it's dry. It's also quite mild. Temperatures between around 14 and 16 Celsius in most towns and cities. So what can we expect over the coming hours? Well, not an awful lot of change. And then through the course of the afternoon, well, let's start with Scotland. We've got plenty of sunny spells on the way. We've scattered fair weather clouds, a top temperature of 18 expected in Edinburgh. In Northern Ireland, it'll be similar. Highs in Belfast should reach 19 Celsius. And then on to Wales. The south of Wales could cloud over at times. If you've been checking your apps, there could be one or two showers lurking on the horizon. They'll be very hit and miss, though. But there is one possible, I think, this afternoon in Cardiff. But it will be warm, 25 degrees. And then across England, it should be a mostly dry day, apart from Cornwall and Devon, which could still catch one or two showers this afternoon. But elsewhere, it's fine. The best of the sunshine from Merseyside through the Midlands into Lincolnshire, East Anglia and the southeast. And it'll be quite warm in Liverpool, 24 degrees. Birmingham 25, London and the southern counties could get into the mid or even high 20s in one or two spots. That's it.
Thomas, thank you for that. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford and Justin Webb in London.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 25th of August. The headlines today, Iran says it has a two-year plan to counter widened US sanctions, described by the White House as the single greatest financial offensive ever. Ministers have announced where more than 70,000 social and affordable homes will be built in England. We'll hear from some of those tasked with constructing them.
It shouldn't take 3 years to identify a site to get a house built on it to get it sold, but it does. So trying to clean up and speed up that process and get the bureaucratic treacle that is in our system running better.
And the trial of a Libyan man over the Lockerbie bombing has been postponed for a third time, just days before it was due to begin.
And coming up in the next hour, why young people leaving care need someone in their corner.
The fact remains that for many young people, when they turn 18, they are plunged into stark isolation and vulnerability, and their outcomes can be devastating.
Ashley John-Baptiste joins us just before 8 o'clock. And AI reaches the shopping trolley, but some old problems remain.
When you're turning, you've got to make sure you've got loads of room to turn. Like, you've got to get a good wide turn because they are really hard to manoeuvre. I think it's just because they're a lot heavier than a normal trolley.
The BBC News read this morning by Jane Steele.
Iran has warned that US plans to cut off the Iranian economy from the rest of the world will end in another defeat for Washington. Last night, the Trump administration set out fresh sanctions as part of what it called the single greatest financial offensive ever. It said the countries that continued to deal with Tehran would share in its isolation. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent, Yulan Nell.
In a defiant response, Iran's finance minister, Ali Madanazida, said sanctions were not new to his country and that it had a two-year plan to deal with the latest ones. It seems they wished to suffer yet another defeat, he told state television. Iran's security chief, Mohsen Rezai, has already warned that Tehran will respond to economic pressure by retaliating against US Gulf allies. He threatened on social media that not a single drop of oil would be exported from the region. The US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said that banks, businesses and countries that dealt with Iran would share its isolation if they refused to cut ties. Iran's largest trading partners include China, Turkey and the United Arab Emirates, which announced last week it was halting all trade and financial transactions with Tehran.
The government has unveiled plans to spend an initial £10 billion building 70,000 social and affordable homes across England as part of a decade-long construction scheme announced last year under Sir Keir Starmer's leadership. Before becoming Prime Minister, Andy Burnham is reported to have said that the entire £39 billion budget of the programme should be spent on council housing. But this first wave of funding aims to ensure 60% of the new properties are available for social rent, in line with the original target. Our correspondent Tara Welsh reports.
Around 8,000 of the 70,000 new homes will be built in Manchester and West Yorkshire. Other regions such as North East England, Liverpool and South Yorkshire will also get a significant share of the funding. £6 billion had already been announced for building in London, where some councils have waiting lists for more than 100 years for a family-sized home. Around 60% of the new homes are expected to be for social rent. Charities have welcomed that, but Shelter says it's not near to the 90,000 social homes a year needed to end homelessness. The Conservatives say the small print of today's announcement shows homes won't have to be delivered until 2039.
A government-commissioned report is warning that young adults who leave care in England are 3 to 4 times more likely to die than other people their age. The authors say more needs to be done to prevent the acute loneliness that some vulnerable care leavers experience. Our correspondent Tom Simons reports.
There have been growing concerns in government about what happens to young people in care homes or being fostered when they become adults. A review for the government by the author and broadcaster Ashley John Baptiste, who grew up in care, and a senior social worker, Claire Chamberlain, found many young people leaving care were profoundly isolated, with no one close enough to notice when things go wrong. In response, the Department for Education is increasing funding to give them better support, from £15 million the year before last to £25 million this year. It'll pay for a programme called Staying Close, which provides accommodation and emotional help from someone they know and trust. Often, that's a member of staff at their former children's home.
A trial in the US of a Libyan man accused of building the bomb that blew up an American airliner over Lockerbie 37 years ago has been postponed for a third time. All 259 passengers and crew on board and 11 people on the ground were killed when Pan Am Flight 103 was destroyed in December 1988. BBC Scotland's Home Affairs correspondent David Cowan reports.
The destruction of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie killed 270 people and remains Britain's worst mass murder. A Libyan man in his 70s, Abu Agila Mohammed Massoud Kir Al-Marimi, has denied building the bomb that brought down the plane. His lawyers requested the delay after telling the courts that newly discovered evidence emerged last Friday. That new information has not been made public, but the judge would have been reluctant to call off the trial at the 11th hour, underlining its potential importance to the case. It's understood a new trial date has been set for January next year.
An advisor to the Russian government has told the BBC that factories in the UK producing drones for Ukraine could come under attack from what he called unknown sources after Britain agreed to share missile technology with Kyiv. Andy Burnham has dismissed previous threats by the Kremlin as outrageous. But Andrei Fyodorov, a former Russian deputy foreign minister, told BBC Newsnight there could be some visible reaction from Moscow towards the UK.
Maybe some hackers attack from unknown source, not from official level, of course. There might be different political steps, and I cannot exclude 100% that there might be some semi-military, for example.
What does semi-military mean?
For example, something might happen with enterprises, with the factories which are producing drones for Ukraine.
Firefighters in Nevada say they've made significant progress in tackling a huge wildfire that has burned around 15,000 acres of land and destroyed dozens of homes. Tens of thousands of people in the city of Reno are still under evacuation orders, although some have been downgraded. Our North America correspondent Shaima Khalil reports.
Crews have now contained more than a quarter of the Hawk Fire, but officials remain concerned that gusts of wind could drive the flames towards more homes. Some residents have been allowed to return to their properties, but around 40,000 people remain under warnings to prepare to evacuate. Since Saturday, walls of orange flames have swept across the foothills around Reno, sending enormous plumes of smoke above the city and threatening to destroy densely populated neighborhoods. Officials say the fire was started by human activity, but whether it was accidental or deliberately set remains under investigation.
Millions of women in England who've missed cervical screening appointments are to be offered at-home testing kits for HPV. The NHS believes the move will help its efforts to eliminate cervical cancer by 2040. More details from our health correspondent Nick Trickle.
Over the next year, nearly 4 million women will receive invites on the NHS app or via text message, email or letter asking them if they want to order a self-testing HPV kit. The offer is being made to those who are not up to date with cervical screening. Around a third of women eligible have missed an appointment. The NHS says there's a variety of reasons women don't come forward, including embarrassment, lack of time or worries about discomfort. And while screening with a clinician is still the best option, the NHS says these kits provide a discreet and convenient alternative.
Morrisons has become the first supermarket in the UK to trial a shopping trolley powered by artificial intelligence. It automatically recognises items as they're placed inside and is being tested by shoppers in Preston. Our business correspondent Peter Ruddick reports.
Developed by an American company, the battery-powered trolleys have a set of cameras and a touchscreen which identify products and tally up the bill as people shop. Shoppers then scan a barcode on the trolley to pay at the till as normal. The trolleys also have an inbuilt scale to weigh loose items, such as fruit and vegetables, although this feature was experiencing some teething problems when BBC News tested the technology. Morrisons told the BBC it was gathering feedback before making any decision on rolling out the technology further, and stressed it would not replace traditional trolleys or store workers.
Peter Ruddick reporting.
Thank you, Jane. It's 9 minutes past seven. The US is launching a new phase of its war on Iran, this one economic, with hopes that tough new sanctions, isolating it from the rest of the world, will fatally weaken the regime in a way the physical conflict so far hasn't. America's Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has called it the greatest financial offensive ever. But Tehran has dismissed the move as propaganda and says it's already been planning ways to withstand the impact. What is clear is that ordinary Iranians are bearing the brunt of the country's economic struggles.
These sanctions are 100% making life difficult. With the incomes we have, we simply cannot make ends meet. My child is now unhappy with me and asks, what kind of a job is driving a taxi that you cannot earn a sufficient income?
Let's speak to Ali Vyas, Deputy Director of the Middle East and North Africa Programme at the International Crisis Group, also one of the authors of the 2024 book, How Sanctions Work, Iran and the Impact of Economic Warfare. Ali, good morning.
Good morning.
As we know, there have been sanctions on Iran for a long time now. What indication is there, if any, that doing this from an international isolation point of view will make any further difference?
Look, as you mentioned, anything that moves in Iran has already been sanctioned by multiple layers of sanctions, in fact. So the question now really is a question of enforcement. Does the United States has what it takes to impose fines and levies on countries that continue to do trade with Iran? And here we're talking primarily about China, which is Iran's biggest trading partner, with whom President Trump started an economic war last year and backed out of it because it backfired on him. And Iran's neighbors like Pakistan, Turkey, Iraq, most of whom have a very good relationship with President Trump and can't really afford to completely cut off ties with Iran, given the fact that they've been neighbors for hundreds of years and probably will remain neighbors for centuries to come.
The UAE is one neighbouring country that announced last week that it would cut economic ties with Iran. But you mentioned China there, Iran's biggest trading partner, and with a slightly different and more difficult relationship with the US. What likelihood is there that President Trump will be able to convince China that it should cut those ties?
It's a very low likelihood, because at the end of the day, this mistake that the United States has committed in the Middle East, which is sapping U.S. power, preventing the United States from pivoting to the East and actually focusing on competition with China, is in the interest of the Chinese. And so there is no reason that they would do anything that would try to help the U.S. extricate itself from the current quagmire that it is in. That's the one element. The second element is that generally the Chinese are against unilateral sanctions. They would comply with multilateral or international sanctions. But unilateral sanctions just imposed by the United States, they have always seen that as illegitimate, and they never wanted to comply with it as to set a precedent.
To what extent, Ali, do you think this is about saving domestic face? The fact that that sanctions regime against Iran did not topple it, the fact that considerable military action earlier this year did not topple it, now they're going back to the first option again. Is it ways to try and disguise, but perhaps very thinly, the fact that, the US cannot do what it's trying to do?
It is a desperate measure to try to basically extract victory from the jaws of defeat. But there is this strong belief in Washington, and this is not a new phenomenon and not unique to this administration, that if pressure against Iran doesn't work, more pressure will. And there is always an elusive search for some kind of mechanism to further tighten the screw that would eventually bring down the Iranian economy and with it the Iranian regime. It has never worked. It will never work simply because the Iranians see this as existential. So they are willing to absorb any pain. And this Iranian regime does not hesitate to transmit that pain to its population in order to remain in power. But, you know, I think the risk now is twofold. One is that this economic D-Day policy, which seems more performative, really, than practical. But let's say it works. If it works, Iran will escalate militarily because it will try to break the deadlock and get out of this blockade and try to impose a cost on the United States and externalize the pain to the outside world. If it doesn't work, then President Trump is also, again, back to square one of pursuing a military option. So those who say sanctions are an alternative to war are mistaken, because this, in fact, is a prelude to war.
Just a final and very brief thought, Ali. When Tehran says that it has already planned over a two-year period ways to withstand the impact, is that likely to be correct and effective?
I think it's as exaggerated as American claims about the effectiveness of sanctions. There is a limit to what Iran can do by planning ahead. At the end of the day, this combination of a naval blockade, years of stagflation inside the country, mismanagement, corruption, and secondary sanctions is having a very sharp impact on the Iranian economy. And you can see it in the devaluation of the currency. So the going is going to get very tough in Iran. But the question is, would that result in capitulation? I think not, because the only thing that the Iranians believe is more dangerous than suffering from U.S. sanctions is surrendering to U.S. terms.
Ali Vyas from the International Crisis Group, thank you.
And that brings us to 7:15. Bus drivers are going on strike in London today, 1,500 of them, after talks with managers broke down. The strike, though, is not about money, it's not about shift patterns, it's about heat. The drivers involved in the strike are not allowed to talk to us. But Alan is a bus driver in the north of England, and he told us what it's like to do his job in sweltering temperatures.
When it's very, very hot, it does affect your concentration levels. You're sweating profusely, perhaps, and that takes your mind off the focus that you have to have on driving safely. So, that has been a challenge, particularly a couple of weeks ago when temperatures were over 35 degrees in the cab. You are stationary. You're sitting still while you're driving. The only thing you can do is have your cab window open and hope that as you're driving above 20 miles an hour, you're going to get a bit of a breeze through that window.
I've been talking to Wayne King from Unite the Union, who is representing the bus drivers who are on strike.
We have legislation in the country that says that you can't transport livestock in temperatures over 30 degrees. To avoid thermal stress and unnecessary suffering of the animals. But you've got drivers driving cabs for hours on end, for 7 days a week, in temperatures that often exceed 40 degrees in the cab. It's just intolerable for them. You know, there's air if you're lucky, there's air conditioning, but that's the minority of buses across the UK and in London. And they've got cooling systems which are not sufficient to keep people safe. In, you know, passengers get on and the buses are hot and uncomfortable, but a passenger can get off. You know, if it's too much, they can get off the bus. But a driver just carries on driving, has to carry on driving to either schedules or there's issues around that as well. It's just completely intolerable for them. It's just unfair. No one should have to be forced to work in those conditions in the 21st century.
And as well as being uncomfortable, it sounds as if it's unsafe.
Well, I think it's fundamentally unsafe. If you're looking at driver fatigue, which is a common problem that we've been campaigning about for a long time as well, if when you then put into it about the lack of hydration because there might not be adequate toilet facilities during the route or at the beginning or end of the route, so they're dehydrating themselves, then that builds up, you know, stress for anybody driving in excessively hot temperatures with no cooling process. Then you're dehydrating. It just becomes really unsafe for the passengers, for the driver especially, and for other road users. You then put into it underlying health conditions that can be exacerbated by it, or you get just continual health conditions.
They also presumably have to cope with worse behaviour among the passengers, but in a sense, because of the heat and because of the upset that they're going to be feeling.
Yeah, I mean, we all have an understanding of how tough it can be in weather, and, you know, and tempers do fray. To pay a fair play to the passengers, they have been really accommodating and accepting of the situation in hot cabs for drivers. You know, and there's quite a few bits on social media that I've seen where passengers have been helpful with drivers. But the wider problem we have about violent, aggressive passengers and antisocial behaviour is just unbelievable.
Now, the strike is going ahead. Why? What is it that the company, that you want the company to do that at the moment they're not?
Well, at the moment, the company have basically, from our members' perspective, given empty promises. Well, we've set up the task force in London with the support of the mayor and TfL that we pushed for and we demanded. And they seem to just want to rely on that and say, well, everything will be resolved by the task force. But the task force is a pan-London process. So Arriva have a problem that they of their own creation. They've not got the right cooling system. They've not got air conditioning. They've only got aircon in a few buses. So it shouldn't just be pushed down the road, which is what we've listened to and had for such a long time now, that it's that they have to take the responsibility as a standalone employer running, you know, hundreds of, possibly thousands of buses across London. We've got 1,500 members out on strike in support of this. They can't just turn around and say, no, we promise we'll do it in a few weeks' time, because members aren't going to accept it. We want things that are more concrete in place.
Wayne King, thank you. And just to say, Arriva, which is the company, Arriva London, the company we've been talking about, so they're disappointed the strike's going ahead. They say 5 out of 8 of their North London bus garages have said they don't want it. They've also said that measures have been introduced this summer to help drivers cope with the extreme heat, and they are investing in air conditioning upgrades for driver cabs across their fleet as well.
It's 7:20. The Confederation of British Industry is calling on the government to roll back one of the policies that the former Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, announced in her first budget nearly 2 years ago, and to cut employers' national insurance contributions ahead of the next one. Leanna Burns back with more on that. Hi again, Leanna.
Hi, Anna. Yes, so the business group is arguing that the cost of employing people has risen so much that it's just harder for businesses to recruit, train and invest. And it's saying reducing the cost of creating jobs will give firms more headroom to hire, particularly hire young people. Joining me now to discuss this is CBI Chief Executive Rain Newton-Smith. Good morning.
Good morning.
So how targeted is this at young people? Because what you're proposing is ultimately a broad tax cut for employers. It's not a youth employment measure.
Well, the business leaders I speak to care deeply about the fact that youth unemployment in the UK is now above the European average. And we have 1 million people of our young people who are not in education, training or in work. And that's a huge waste of talent. And at the same time, they say the costs of employing people have gone up so much. And one of the challenges is that when you're looking to create a new opportunity, you have to make sure that that opportunity is available to all workers, regardless of age. And so what we're calling on the Chancellor to do is to consider ahead of the next budget measures that would really help to reduce that cost of employment, because we need to see more growth, more opportunity in our economy to ensure that we're not wasting the potential that is out there and leaving our young people out of the labour market with scarring effects throughout their lifetime.
Now, the government has already launched a new multi-billion pound youth unemployment strategy to target this. So is that not enough?
We absolutely think it needs to go further. And we do think we need to look at that cost of employment, because the business leaders I speak to say that the cost of doing business has gone up so much that it's holding them back from creating opportunities. National insurance contribution is the highest tax overall that businesses are paying. It's gone up by over 27%. But of course, tax is not all of the issue. What they're saying is businesses really want to work with the government to create more opportunities. And whether that's sitting down and looking at the Employment Rights Act and working with unions to make sure that that doesn't make it harder for businesses to take a chance on young people, whether that's creating more work experience opportunities, whether that's working with Skills England to make sure that we have opportunities for young people.
But just very quickly, where do we find the billions to pay for it?
Well, I think that what we think is over time, this would create more growth in the economy. And when we see more growth in the economy and more opportunities, that saves money for the government and ultimately leads to higher tax receipts. And also, we're mindful that this measure does need to be targeted. We're not asking for a full reversal of the national insurance contribution increase we saw in previous budgets, but a targeted measure to really help support and reduce the cost of employment so we can see more growth, more opportunities, particularly for our young people.
Ray Newton-Smith, CBI Chief Executive, thank you so much.
Thank you, Leanna. It's exactly 24 minutes past seven. Morrisons has launched AI-powered trolleys, which can recognise the products that we put in there. It can weigh your produce. It can even keep a running total of how much we're spending. So is it an extra level of convenience that will make shopping trips quicker, easier maybe? Or is it an added hit of surveillance that we're not ready for just yet? Our reporter Katie Hazeldine's been to Preston to try the tech out.
Just arrived at Morrison's. I'm here to buy the ingredients to make a vegetarian lasagna, and I'm going to buy the ingredients using one of these AI trolleys. My initial thoughts are this: you don't need a pound for the trolley, which is good because I don't have any change with me. The trolley is, it kind of looks more like a big basket on wheels because it's made of like plastic and it's grey, and it's a lot heavier than a normal trolley. Right in front of you, there's a screen. There are three cameras. So when you take something off the shelf and put it into the trolley, you sort of scan the item and then you put it into the trolley. And I suppose that way it detects whether or not it's the right item. Anyway, I'm going to have a go with it now. And first off, I need to find some lasagna sheets. I've secured the lasagna sheets. And I found the barcode, so I'm going to scan it. Scanned. Put it in the trolley. And it's, 75p has added to my total. Okay, next I need some cherry tomatoes. One thing I will say about this trolley is, when you're turning, you've got to make sure you've got loads of room to turn. Like, you've got to get a good wide turn, because they are really hard to manoeuvre. I think it's just because they're a lot heavier than a normal trolley, so I'm just not used to it. Need a bit of milk for the white sauce. The total on my screen has now gone up to £3. As I'm walking round the supermarket, I've noticed that most people haven't opted for the smart trolley yet. They're all still using the traditional trolley or a basket. I'm going to see if I can find somebody that's giving it a go. Excuse me, sorry to bother you. My name's Katie, I work for the BBC. You said it's your first time using a smart trolley. How's the experience going so far?
It was difficult at the beginning, but it's actually not too bad. Once you get the hang of it, it's all right.
Yeah. And why did you decide to have a go on the smart trolley rather than using a traditional trolley?
I think it's just easier and quicker. Yeah. It's a big shop today, so I thought it might be worth a shot. Why
and
not?
Is it helpful to sort of see things as you're shopping, like the price go up?
It is. I do like to know how much it is before I pay for it. So seeing a total before I actually go and pay for it is fantastic.
Right, I've got everything I need now. On my little screen it says checkout, so I'm going to click on that. It says pay at the self-checkout. Okay, so you use the scanner to scan the barcode on the screen, and it's like connecting the trolley to the screen at the self-checkout. It says mobile cart transfer is complete. Touch pay. Okay.
All card accepted.
Pay.
Thank you for shopping at Morrison's.
Katie Hasseltine, shopping at Morrison's in Preston in a way that is probably coming to you too soon. 27 minutes past seven. It is time for the sport. Here again is Hugh.
Justin, hello to you. The natural climax to a Grand Slam tennis tournament right at the end. Organisers have spent the last couple of years thinking of ways they might capture our attention a little more at the beginning too. The Australian Open has its one-point slam for $1 million, while at the US Open, that's also the prize money on offer for the winner of its star-studded mixed doubles event, played today and tomorrow at Flushing Meadows before the main draw starts on Sunday. It'll see the return of Serena Williams to the US Open, who at the age of 44 will be hoping to win another Grand Slam title as she pairs up with Carlos Alcaraz, one of the eye-catching if unconventional pairings, as Russell Fuller reports from New York.
12 months ago, the US Open decided to revolutionise the mixed doubles by staging it over just 2 days and giving entry preference to singles players. There was only one pair of specialist doubles players in the draw. Sara Errani and Andrea Vavasori described the move as profoundly wrong before showing the singles players exactly how to do it and pocketing a $1 million first prize. The Italians are back to defend their title and will have the support of a few more doubles specialists this year, as Britain's Henry Patton and Lloyd Glasspool both came through yesterday's new qualifying competition. But the focus will be on the singles stars. Serena Williams will be playing here for the first time since retiring, or so we thought, in 2022. Her partner Carlos Alcaraz has not played a match since April because of a wrist injury. And maybe Novak Djokovic can do something he has never done before, and that is win a mixed doubles match at a Grand Slam.
Yes, Novak Djokovic is paired with women's world number one Aryna Sabalenka. The Serb is still searching for what would be a record 25th Grand Slam title in the singles. That's 3 years on from his 24th, which was claimed at the US Open. Djokovic revealed after a surprise early defeat in Cincinnati this month that he has been dealing with a long-standing health condition that particularly affects him in hot conditions. But his former rival Roger Federer insists you should not count him out, even at the age of 39.
I feel like whenever Novak enters any tournament for that matter, or a major, he'll be in it with a shot. Anyway, that's my opinion. You know, I have very high regards of Novak. I've seen what he can do, not just once, not just here, not just there. He's done it in every place and, you know, at the highest of levels.
And we'll hear the thoughts of Joe Root today, with the England captain facing the media a day earlier than usual, perhaps part of a strategy to deal with the most recent disciplinary issue facing an England cricketer and then attempting to move on. Brydon Carse has been removed from the squad for the second test against Pakistan at Lord's, which starts on Thursday after being arrested briefly and pictured in handcuffs during a night out at the weekend. The cricket investigator has started an investigation, but the former England captain Michael Vaughan says that will not stop the questions coming.
I think Joe Root will be absolutely fuming with this situation, because he would have been hoping to arrive at Lord's to talk about cricket, to talk about his team, how well they played last week. Probably the same team will go again on Thursday. And now he'll have to answer all these questions about curfews, discipline, drinking culture, everything that we thought had been brushed under the carpet and moved to one side. We're pretty much back to square one.
That's Michael Vaughan. Coming up in an hour's time, the former All Blacks captain Sean Fitzpatrick on the series against South Africa. They are calling the greatest rivalry.
Thank you, Hugh. Now, a word on some musical weekend listening.
Soul music.
There's huge tenderness in it.
The series exploring the powerful emotional impact of music.
While it represents loss for me, I've been able to see so much beauty.
To my love, took it down.
Featuring Fleetwood Mac and a global disco hit.
Music became frozen in time. People held on to the music instead of fading away.
Soul music. The new series continues on Saturday mornings at 10:30. To listen on your smart speaker, just say Play Radio 4.
Coming up in the next half hour, return to local councils building houses. That is what we're being promised by the government this morning. Is it going to work? We will find out in a few minutes' time.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb in London and Anna Foster in Salford. And at 28 minutes to 8, Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
Iran has responded defiantly to a US threat to cut its economy off from the rest of the world, warning it will end in another defeat for Washington. Last night, the Trump administration set out fresh sanctions as part of what it called the single greatest financial offensive ever. It said that countries that continued to deal with Tehran would share in its isolation. The government has set out plans to spend £10 billion on building more than 70,000 social and affordable homes across England. The project is the first stage of a wider £39 billion scheme previously announced by the former Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer. The Conservatives have warned that the new homes won't have to be delivered until 2039. A government-commissioned report has warned that young adults who leave care in England are 3 to 4 times more likely to die than other people their age. The authors say more needs to be done to prevent the acute loneliness that some vulnerable care leavers experience. The Department for Education says it is increasing funding to provide better support. A judge in the United States has agreed to delay the trial of a Libyan man accused of building the bomb that blew up an American airliner over Lockerbie 37 years ago. 270 people were killed when Pan Am Flight 103 was destroyed in December 1988. The delay was requested by the suspect's defence team, which said new evidence had emerged in the case. Andy Burnham has told the Bloomberg News organisation that he plans to travel to Washington with other European leaders next month to try to persuade President Trump to allow Ukraine to access American Patriot air defence missile stocks. The Prime Minister was speaking on a visit to Kiev, where he confirmed that Britain would help Ukraine build its own supply of cruise missiles. Millions of women in England who have missed cervical screening appointments are to be offered at-home testing kits. Those who test positive for high-risk HPV will then be invited for a follow-up cervical screening appointment.
Thank you for that. It is 26 minutes to 8. We're being told this morning that house building, council house building, is returning at scale to England. 70,000 homes in 10 years, another target. How likely is it that this target is achieved? Can the council simply begin building right now? What are the constraints and how easy are they to overcome? Back in the day, in the 1950s, councils were building almost 200,000 new council homes a year. In 2025, that figure was just 1,970. Many councils haven't built a home for decades, preferring to leave it to housing associations to do. But Andy Burnham's announcement today does put the focus back on councils. I've been talking to Jonathan Seddon, who's the chief executive of the Seddon Group that built over 500 houses last year. And we started with how realistic it is, this balance between what the government says it's spending and what's achievable.
I think any extra money is always welcome. I think it's not just the money that the government's previously promised and now they're getting around to spending. It's the whole gambit of what they are doing for the planning process, trying to clean up and speed up that process and get the bureaucratic treacle that is in our system running better.
Tell us more about the treacle.
It shouldn't take 3 years to identify a site to get a house built on it to get it sold, but it does. And sometimes it can take longer than that. So making that quicker, you've got a NPPF, the National Policy Planning Framework, which was released and talked about last week. That will speed things up if they follow through with the promises on that, which is one of the key elements is officers' recommendations being enough to get planning awarded, not having to go to local councillors who've got a different agenda. They're doing a different job with a different agenda. So it's understandable, but it's very costly and it's very time consuming.
But you think if that treacle, as you call it, can be got rid of, then the target that the government has for councils is achievable?
I think the 1.5 million houses in this parliament is long gone. Everybody knows that. I think what they've done in having a 10-year framework is very good. It's taken a long time to get to this stage where the money's become available and a lot of local authorities, a lot of housing associations have readied themselves because they've heard it's come in, it's been presented to them. You know, because it does take so long, 3 years to get a site from identified to start, it needs to be that window. And then they can invest in people and people skills. Because lots of local authorities don't have development teams. So they're going to have to rely on either consultants or the private sector to fill that void. But it also allows a longer-term strategic view on employment, apprentices. If you've got a long pipeline of work, you can have an apprentice. An apprenticeship's now 2 or 3 years. So it really does feed into the whole machine of long-term good growth.
Tell us more about what you need to put in place then for the building to start. So at the moment, if they just came and said, OK, let's start building, you're saying that the people with the necessary skills just aren't there.
No, I think they are. At the moment, they are. But the house building market isn't in a good shape. The spec housing market, so selling houses to the public, is in the doldrums, quite frankly. We only build 250, 300 houses a year. We've got high stock levels at the moment. Our spec house building business is plodding along, but it could go a lot faster. So, you know, there is slack in the system, so you can get tradespeople at the moment. My worry, and it is, I think, a valid worry, is when the herd turns, it all turns together. And then all resources will get utilised very quickly, and we will be having a shortage of bricklayers and plumbers and plasterers. But at the moment, yeah, there is availability.
So they could start now. So basically the beginning of this plan, and it's 70,000, isn't it, social and affordable homes in 10 years. There's nothing to stop it starting now.
No, and I think there's a lot of schemes ready to go now. So I think this is welcome news, good timing. It's probably a little bit later than we all hoped, but it is good for the industry because, you know, the construction industry as a whole will benefit from this, which is great.
That was Jonathan Seddon. Let us talk live now to Wendy Evans-Hendrick, who is Chief Executive at Hendrick Orwell Housing Association. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Are you similarly optimistic?
I am. I mean, I think this government has shown a real commitment to growing affordable and social housing. As Jonathan said in the interview earlier, it's not easy. It's not easy to turn development on and move at pace. You know, these things take time. But I think the sector has been, you know, ready and waiting for this announcement today.
Interesting that he's saying that the people are ready to do the work right now. But if it really does get going, then there will need to be more of them in the future. So to what extent do you think the government has to think not just about the target for house building, but, for instance, the target for having enough people who are trained at the various trades that are needed?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and we've seen this before when we've had housing booms that, you know, there's been a lack of trades or the price just goes up and everything becomes, you know, unaffordable. I think, you know, the investment and the focus on more apprenticeships and more T skills and making, you know, the prospect of a career in housing development attractive to young people again, I think is going to be key to making this work.
What about the council's ability to do it? So you're from a housing association. There's been a lot of interest in housing associations doing it. It is very obvious from this morning that they want the councils to be in charge. From your perspective, have the councils got what they need to do that job?
I mean, I think it's probably patchy in terms of, you know, we've already got some councils who've been building council houses already. And I think we're seeing, you know, a growth in the maturity of council housing building again across the country from, you know, a standing start where they weren't building for a number of decades. But that is, again, going to take time to grow. I mean, I think the good thing is the relationship between housing associations and local authority partners is really close. We work really closely with our local authority partners and both support them in their own council house building programmes, but they also enable us to build our own social housing, you know, within their districts and boroughs. So I think it's very much a joint approach by councils and housing associations if we're going to stand any chance to hit any of these targets.
And what's happening to the treacle, as Jonathan said and rather memorably called it, all the stuff that you have to, all the hoops you have to go through, all the planning, etc., etc.? I mean, I suppose I was going to say, has it been swept aside? It obviously hasn't been swept aside and possibly shouldn't be swept aside. But to what extent can you see this government genuinely grappling with it and trying to reduce it?
I mean, I think, as Jonathan said, I think we've seen some really promising things come through the new MPFF and
the MPFF being
the National Planning Framework, right. That's just been published. We're yet to see that obviously happen. you know, where a lot of these documents are published, aren't they? It does take much, much longer to get development up and running now than it has in the past, for lots of good reasons, you know, lots of environmental reasons and lots of surveys and things that need to be completed. The bottleneck, if you like, of, you know, finding the piece of land, getting planning permission and finally putting a digger on the site and digging, you know, can be quite a long period of time.
I was going to ask you just finally about finding the piece of land. So do we think, is it your view that in councils around the country and specifically those that Labour are thinking about now, that actually the land that should be being used is or has already been identified? It's there. People know where it is. I mean, how far down the process are we, I suppose, is the question.
Again, I suspect it's very regionally based. I mean, I think lots of local authorities have already done quite a lot of land investigation. Some of those that have been building already have already started on certainly council-owned land. I think if we're going to see anything like the level of social housing building, as it has been alluded to, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, there will need to be, you know, quite large areas of land identified and taken through a planning process that probably, you know, haven't been as yet, because we're talking about a step up in scale that, you know, we haven't seen for quite a number of years.
Okay, Wendy Evans-Hendrick, thank you very much for talking to us.
It's 17 minutes to 8.
A memorial was held yesterday for one of the young men killed in Saturday's crash on the A66 that also, of course, killed two police officers. Family and friends of Jakub Matusiak set off flares and released balloons on South Bank Field in Middlesbrough near the site of the incident. Police are investigating that crash and have arrested 12 people on suspicion of a range of offences, including possession of a firearm and being part of an organised crime group. What do individual police officers make of the reaction there has been to that terrible crash? Paul Williams is on the line, who's the acting deputy national chair of the Police Federation. Good morning to you.
Hello, how are we doing?
Good, thank you. And there's been a reaction, hasn't there, on both sides? So just looking at the two police officers and the reaction to their deaths, PC Blades and PC Clough, an enormous public outpouring of sympathy for their families and support for them.
Yes, and rightly so. It's been such a tragic incident that could easily have been avoided, and through no fault of the police officers who just went out, left the homes that night just to do their job. This is absolutely devastating for the policing community.
What do you make of the efforts that have been to mark the lives of the boys and men who died, two 17-year-olds and the others who were in that car? What do you make of the public reaction to that and the fact that their lives were commemorated in the way that they were?
It's really not for me to judge on reaction to life or death situations. People air their grief in different ways. I don't want to be judging jury around that. My priority, though, my thoughts are with the police officers and their families, and the policing community that have to deal with this tragedy.
There has been some effort made, hasn't there, to think about what can be done in the future, not only to make the police officers in these terrible situations safer, but also actually to stop these incidents happening. And one of the things that people have drawn attention to is a reduction in the number of traffic police that there are. There are many more cameras, aren't there, but fewer police.
Yeah, I mean, traffic police are absolutely essential on our roads. They're very highly trained. They are trained to police the roads, to make sure the roads are safe, but also trained to deal with incidents as and when they arrive, and deal with the criminals on the roads. Not just bad driving, but organised crime that pass through these roads. They're an essential part of policing, and cutting those numbers just isn't acceptable.
I think, I wonder if we convinced ourselves that a lot of it could be done through cameras. And of course, you can catch people through cameras, and you can see cars that are being badly driven, etc., etc. But that sort of deterrent that isn't there with cameras, is it? And is if you've got actual police.
That's right. Now, cameras have a place. Technology has a place in policing. No one will deny that. But personnel need to be involved in policing. It's okay capturing things on camera, but there's still resources required to deal with that as and when. And actually seeing police officers out there is the biggest deterrent, which will prevent things from happening. And hopefully you wouldn't have to catch this on camera. It's essential we've got personnel on the front line, and at the moment it's just not happening.
Paul Williams, Acting Deputy National Chair of the Police Federation. Thank you.
It is 13 minutes to 8. In a few minutes' time, the broadcaster Ashley John-Baptiste tells us why care leavers like him are more likely to die young and what we can do to try and help. But before that, it's time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is Mona Siddiqui, Professor of Religion and Society at King's College London.
Good morning. When my children were at school, I knew I wanted them to have the opportunity to learn at least one musical instrument. Of course, I hoped they would learn to play and read music, but to also appreciate the discipline that goes into any creative art. My eldest was around 11 when he first complained about piano practice, saying, "All my friends have now given up." But I simply replied, "I know it's hard now, but when you're 18, playing the piano will be the coolest thing you do." I had only enjoyed a few piano lessons as a child, and to be honest, I knew I wanted them to continue with music because I hadn't been able to. But I also saw music as central, not marginal, to their education. Something that would help them understand life, learn to see and listen to the world more deeply. Of course, music can be learnt and played in many ways, but the recent Ofqual report, which shows A-level music entries falling by 4.9%, should tell us something uncomfortable about what we value. The number of young people also taking arts GCSEs in state schools has fallen by just over 40% since 2010. It shouldn't surprise us that in an education system increasingly driven by grades, employability, and measurable outcomes, music can look like a luxury. And it's futile to pit the arts against the sciences. Both are creative, have intrinsic worth, and contribute to the economic and cultural life of any society. A civilization needs both the knowledge to change the world, but also the imagination to ask whether it is changing it for the better. But maybe the true value of the arts lies in its subversive potential, the capacity to leave us unsettled. A piece of music can break open a memory, a poem can make us see a familiar injustice differently, and a song can turn strangers into a community. In a world seemingly obsessed by the power of technology, the arts always whisper, "Look again," to remind us of our humanity. Like all forms of beauty, music can connect us to eternity. This understanding was intrinsic to the Islamic intellectual tradition, where poetry, imagination, and the ascetic experience weren't seen as distractions from truth, but as ways of approaching it. The great Muslim polymath Al-Ghazali saw beauty not as an escape from God, but as a way of noticing God. There are many reasons why young people don't take up or continue with music at school, but if we ignore the arts, our lives will be so much poorer for it. After all, before young people learn how to make a living, they also need spaces where they can learn how to feel, to wonder, and to love.
And that was Thought for the Day with Mona Siddiqui, who's Professor of Religion and Society at King's College London. It brings us to 10 to 8.
Young people who've left the care system have an early death rate that's around 3 to 4 times higher than the general population. And a new government-commissioned independent review suggests that that is linked to being left alone, essentially, without the safety net and support that they need when they reach 18. It's looked at the lives of 6 young people in particular, all of whom died before the age of 24, as well as exploring the wider statistics on how care leavers cope when they get too old for the system. I spoke a little earlier to Ashley John-Baptiste, the author and broadcaster who grew up in care himself and has co-chaired this government review, and he told me that much of this reminds him of his own experiences.
Growing up in care, I was shunted, and I say shunted because that's how it felt, between four foster homes and a care home. My last foster family were brilliant, but I had to leave them at 18 years old. And I was placed into my council flat, and I vividly remember the first night being there alone with a mattress on the living room floor, because I, you know, couldn't afford a bed frame, and just that deep sense of abandonment and isolation that I felt as an 18-year-old care leaver. I'd aged out of care overnight, and I was made to live alone and work out how to be an adult.
It feels like something that should be so obvious, something that doesn't happen outside the care system, that support and that help is there for people. And now you've looked into this in more depth. It is really a widespread issue.
Yeah, well, the review that I've been commissioned to co-chair is about the early deaths of care leavers, which in my view is a national tragedy. In 2025, the Department for Education received 112 notifications of deaths of care leavers in England aged 18 to 24. And that sort of statistic shouldn't just reel off the tongue. 112 young lives lost needlessly. Now, of that number, more deaths occurred at 18 than at any other age within that bracket. And of those 112 deaths, 40 were young people who died by taking their lives. So this is really serious stuff. It's just lives ending far too soon. And so we took that data and we chose six stories to delve into. We wanted to get a sense of who those young people were. We spoke to professionals and loved ones connected to those young people. And I say, you know, it was emotional. It was hard work. But we learned of a young mum who at 23 years old, she had grown up in care herself. At 23 years old, she had three children. Her children were the main source of her self-esteem. And she was in a vulnerable position at 23, where she was faced with the threat of losing her children to adoption. She had told her sister, who we spoke to, that if she were to lose her kids, that she would end it. And of course, she did. She took her life. We learned of an 18-year-old who had grown up in care. He just felt from the start issues of sexual abuse. He had lived across 10 foster placements. He, at 18 years old, was placed into custody in an adult prison for a minor offence. 2 weeks into custody, he was found dead in his cell. He'd taken his life. This is a really hard read, this review, but it is so important that people are aware of the plight that so many care leavers face. To know that there are so many care leavers who end it because they don't believe their life is worth living because of the challenges they face in terms of leaving care. Well, that is a national tragedy.
Yeah. I think what you highlight as well there, Ashley, that the stories, you know, these are not just numbers and statistics, as you said. When you hear the stories of people, it accentuates the issue here, and it really drives forward the fact that not enough is being done because people aren't being considered as humans with feelings and problems and issues that need to be dealt with and need to be supported.
Yeah, absolutely. You grow up in care, you may have a foster parent, you have a range of levers of support, and the moment you turn 18, as a young person in care, you age out. A young person that I spoke to for this review said that readiness is not dependent on age, and that support needs to be needs-based and not age-based. And I found that statement really powerful. The fact remains that for many young people, when they turn 18, they are plunged into stark isolation and vulnerability, and their outcomes can be devastating.
Are you confident, Ashley, that something will change as a result of this, that this is not a review which will make headlines today, which will then be forgotten about in the future?
I think optimism is important. I mean, it's welcome that, you know, the government is committing money to supporting care leavers to the age of 25. And of course, the recent children's bill is welcome news too. But the fact remains that until this issue of leaving care at 18 is dealt with properly, until there's systemic change, actually, these problems will persist. So in our review, we do set out thoughts about what the government can do, but also about what local authorities and heads of children's services can do across the country to make sure that they're better supporting their care leavers.
Ashley John-Baptiste, co-chair of that review. Thank you.
Thanks.
And that brings us to 3 minutes to eight. Just to say, after 8 o'clock, we're going to be talking to the Housing Minister about this morning's announcements on how we're going to build more houses, specifically how councils are going to build them. We'll also be talking to a former colleague of the US Treasury Secretary about the sanctions the US government hopes are going to bring Iran to the negotiating table. And on Radio 4 later today.
On BBC iPlayer.
There is a problem. A British contractor was shot in Svalbard up in the Arctic Circle.
Put down the gun!
This is DCI Silver.
I know who she is.
We have to keep things contained.
They go to war over this.
This is not the fight you can win.
The Russians are here, and it looks like they've come mob-handed.
Let's all stay calm. Okay, no one needs to get hurt. We need backup.
Amy, no!
The new series of Vigil starts on Sunday on BBC iPlayer.
Let's see what the weather looks like today with Thomas Schaffernacker.
Thanks very much, Anna. Looking a little bit further ahead over the next sort of 2-3 days, we are expecting a fair amount of rain in some areas. Now, obviously, there's been so little rain this summer, particularly in southern and central areas. But now it looks as though rain clouds will be gathering. And over the next 24 hours, we'll start to see the first storms, I think, drifting into southern parts of the UK. There could be quite a lot of rain in some spots, perhaps an inch of rain, 25 millimetres in some areas. So some flash flooding is possible. And that will start tonight, and then we'll see more through the course of Wednesday, and then I think especially Thursday, that's when we could see some very heavy rain spreading across England and Wales. So be prepared for some downpours, and it might come as a shock to some areas that have seen, you know, just dry and sunny weather for weeks and weeks and weeks. So that's the outlook. How about the here and now? Well, many of us are waking up to fine weather this morning. It's beautiful currently across East Anglia and the southeast. Fine weather across much of northern and central Scotland, just a few scattered fair weather clouds. Some areas are a little cloudy, and today we could catch a few showers across the southwest of England. I think Cornwall, Devon, Somerset could see showers both this morning and this afternoon. And we've also had a few sprinkles of fleeting rain in the far northeast of England and also around the Scottish borders. But elsewhere it's dry, and that's how it's going to be this afternoon. And quite warm and muggy. It already is quite warm and muggy this morning, but temperatures today in the southern counties as well as the southeast of England could shoot up to 26 or 7 Celsius, easily mid-20s for Birmingham, about 24 for the northwest of England. And obviously the further north we go, it'll be a little bit fresher. I think for Belfast, Edinburgh and Glasgow, it'll be closer to around 18 or 19 Celsius. And then just a reminder, those showers gather this evening. So tonight there could be some downpours in the south, and there's more on the way throughout Wednesday and then especially Thursday.
Thomas, thank you for that. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford, Justin Webb in London.
Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 25th of August. The headlines this morning: Iran has insisted it is fully prepared for further sanctions announced by the US, saying it has a 2-year plan that will inflict another defeat on Washington.
The going is going to get very tough in Iran, but the question is, would that result in capitulation? I think not, because the only thing that the Iranians believe is more dangerous than suffering from US sanctions is surrendering to US terms.
The government has set out details of the first phase of a house building programme that aims to provide 300,000 social and affordable homes in England. We'll hear from the minister responsible at 20 past eight. And the US trial of a Libyan man who denies building the bomb that blew up an airliner over Lockerbie has been postponed for a third time after new evidence emerged last week.
Also coming up in the next hour, are we really coming to terms with the global power of China? I'm going to be talking to the US economist Brad Setzer on how to balance the rewards and the risks. What happens if the pressure for a journalist to get a scoop overtakes the obligation to tell the truth?
Every time I bring a story back, Pat edits it to death. She says it's not positive enough.
A new play examines the consequences, and should you have to pay more to park your car if it's bigger? We will debate that. The BBC News read this morning by Jane Steele.
Iran has warned that US plans to cut off the Iranian economy from the rest of the world will end in another defeat for Washington. Last night, the Trump administration set out fresh sanctions as part of what it called the single greatest financial offensive ever. It said that countries that continued to deal with Tehran would share in its isolation. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent, Yulan Nell.
In a defiant response, Iran's finance minister, Ali Madanazidah, said sanctions were not new to his country and that it had a 2-year plan to deal with the latest ones. It seems they wished to suffer yet another defeat, he told state television. Iran's security chief, Mohsen Rezai, has already warned that Tehran will respond to economic pressure by retaliating against US Gulf allies. He threatened on social media that not a single drop of oil would be exported from the region. The US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said that banks, businesses and countries that dealt with Iran would share its isolation if they refused to cut ties. Iran's largest trading partners include China, Turkey and the United Arab Emirates, which announced last week it was halting all trade and financial transactions with Tehran.
The government has unveiled plans to spend an initial £10 billion building 70,000 social and affordable homes across England as part of a decade-long construction scheme announced last year under Keir Starmer's leadership. Before becoming Prime Minister, Andy Burnham is reported to have said that the entire £39 billion budget of the programme should be spent on council housing, but this first wave of funding aims to ensure 60% of the new properties are available for social rent, in line with the original target. Our correspondent Tara Welsh reports.
Around 8,000 of the 70,000 new homes will be built in Manchester and West Yorkshire. Other regions such as North East England, Liverpool and South Yorkshire will also get a significant share of the funding. £6 billion had already been announced for building in London, where some councils have waiting lists for more than 100 years for a family-sized home. Around 60% of the new homes are expected to be for social rent. Charities have welcomed that, but Shelter says it's not near to the 90,000 social homes a year needed to end homelessness. The Conservatives say the small print of today's announcement shows homes won't have to be delivered until 2039.
A government-commissioned report is warning that young adults who leave care in England are 3 to 4 times more likely to die than other people their age. The authors say more needs to be done to prevent the acute loneliness that some vulnerable care leavers experience. Our correspondent Tom Simons reports.
There have been growing concerns in government about what happens to young people in care homes or being fostered when they become adults. A review for the government by the author and broadcaster Ashley John-Baptiste, who grew up in care, and a senior social worker, Claire Chamberlain, found many young people leaving care were profoundly isolated, with no one close enough to notice when things go wrong. In response, the Department for Education is increasing funding to give them better support, from £15 million the year before last to £25 million this year. It'll pay for a programme called Staying Close, which provides accommodation and emotional help from someone they know and trust. Often, that's a member of staff at their former children's home.
A trial in the US of a Libyan man accused of building the bomb that blew up an American airliner over Lockerbie 37 years ago has been postponed for a third time. All 259 passengers and crew on board and 11 people on the ground were killed when Pan Am Flight 103 was destroyed in December 1988. BBC Scotland's Home Affairs correspondent David Cowan reports.
The destruction of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie killed 270 people and remains Britain's worst mass murder. A Libyan man in his 70s, Abu Aguila Mohamed Massoud Kir Al-Marimi, has denied building the bomb that brought down the plane. His lawyers requested the delay after telling the courts that newly discovered evidence emerged last Friday. That new information has not been made public, but the judge would have been reluctant to call off the trial at the 11th hour, underlining its potential importance to the case. It's understood a new trial date has been set for January next year.
Andy Burnham has told the Bloomberg News organisation that he plans to travel to Washington with other European leaders next month to try to persuade President Trump to allow Ukraine to access American Patriot air defence missile stocks. The Prime Minister was speaking on a visit to Kiev, where he confirmed that Britain would help Ukraine build its own supply of cruise missiles. An advisor to President Putin has suggested British factories producing weapons for Ukraine could come under attack, telling the BBC he could not exclude what he called semi-military action by unknown sources. Women who've missed cervical cancer screening appointments in England are to be offered self-testing kits by the NHS. The measure is designed to get more patients checked for the HPV virus, which causes nearly all cases of the disease. The head of health information at Cancer Research UK, Fiona Osgoode, told us that women should still try to attend screening appointments if possible.
It's really important to say that actually the best way to take part in cervical screening is still that routine in clinic, going to a GP, making an appointment, or going to a sexual health clinic and making an appointment. And that's because the sample being taken is a sample of the cervical cells itself, whereas the at-home test is just using a swab. So it's slightly different. It's more just testing if there is HPV. It's not getting a specific reading from your cervix.
The trade body representing Australia's music industry says it will ban songs made primarily with artificial intelligence from the country's official charts. It's in response to a hit cover version of Madonna's Like a Prayer that used AI-generated vocals and drums. More from our Australia reporter Simon Atkinson.
For months, a cover of Madonna's Like a Prayer has ridden high in the Australian charts, notching up almost 50 million streams on Spotify. The catch? The version by Australian DJ Josh Farwas relies heavily on artificial intelligence. Now, songs like this will no longer be able to battle for the number one spot in Australia, after the country's Recording Industry Association changed the rules on what can enter the charts. AI can still be used in production, but humans must have written the song, performed the lead vocal, and played the main instruments. Earlier this year, Sweden's chart removed an AI-generated song, but Australia is thought to be among the first countries to implement a broader ban. The move has been welcomed by musicians, with one high-profile Australian group, Peking Duck, saying AI music was removing the human experience from life.
The first 10p coins bearing the portrait of the king are entering circulation across the UK. The Royal Mint says more than 7 million of the coins are being released. Here's our cost of living correspondent, Kevin Peachey.
Look closely and you might find the King's image on 5p, 50p and £1 coins. King Charles coins still only represent about 1% of the 24 billion coins in circulation in the UK. But from today, collectors and enthusiasts can find his portrait on the 10p too. These new coins may be relatively scarce, but the Kappa Kaylee, which features on the reverse side of the 10p, is even more rare. The huge woodland grouse is only found in small areas of Scotland, is at risk of extinction and is on the UK Conservation Red List.
A collection of Freddie Mercury's costumes is to go on display at the V&A Museum in London to mark what would have been his 80th birthday. It will feature outfits worn by the Queen frontman at key stages of his career, as Eve Coleman explains. She's a killer
queen. The singer behind Killer Queen was also known for some killer looks. Freddie Mercury's Splendid Things was developed with the star's former fiancé and close friend Mary Austin. I see a little silhouette of a man. The look spanned the 1970s and 80s, featuring the Mercury Wing catsuit from the Bohemian Rhapsody music video and a crown and cloak designed by Diana Mosley, worn on the Magic Tour. It was during this tour in 1986 that Freddie Mercury made his final stage appearance with Queen before his death at the age of 45. The V&A says the exhibit will spotlight his flamboyance, charisma and the creativity that helped define his enduring legacy.
Eve Coleman reporting.
Thank you, Jane. It's 10 minutes past eight. The single greatest financial offensive ever, an economic D-Day. The US has so far failed to topple the Iranian regime through military means. Now it's hoping an increased campaign targeting Iran's already struggling finances will tip the balance in its favour. Tehran said overnight it was already fully prepared and had a two-year plan in place to counter the raft of tough new sanctions. This is how US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent announced them.
Iran now faces a very clear choice with only two paths before them. Complete global isolation and a subsistence economy, or a path back to normalcy with an opportunity to rejoin the global economy. Today, we are launching Operation Economic Outcast to foreclose every other option available to the Iranian regime. We want to make clear here today that no one is above the reach of U.S. sanctions, that if they facilitate transactions and are part of the ecosystem that turns Iranian oil into money, into repression, they will be targeted.
Well, the aviation industry, gold and digital assets are all in the US's crosshairs, and it's also threatening to punish other countries who don't join it in economically isolating Iran. Well, I spoke earlier to Miad Maleki. He's senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He was a senior US sanctions strategist at the US Treasury until last August.
What I can tell you is, you know, during the first Trump administration, we spent about 3 years President Trump to reinstitute U.S. economic sanctions that the Iran nuclear deal had revoked. Took us about 2 or 3 years to rebuild those sanctions against the Iranian regime. And then we came to this phase of very aggressive engagements with foreign jurisdictions such as UAE and China to get them to enforce sanctions. So what's happening today is repeat of that. So at this stage, Treasury Department is going to really focus on engagements with countries where Iran is still operating.
We know that the Iranian economy is struggling and has been for some time now. What evidence is there that additional sanctions in a situation like that will create the hurt that the US government is hoping it will?
Well, it's difficult to assess if this is going to, you know, additional sanctions, you know, are going to really change the decision making or bring about a behavior change or policy change in Iran, in Tehran. But what the Treasury Department, the U.S. administration is hoping to see happening here is a kind of a domestic economic pressure to the point that the regime is going to have to make a decision whether putting up with potential domestic uprisings or serious shortages of food and goods and other essential in Iran, or not being able to pay salaries of government employees. Now, they're probably going to keep paying, but with the inflation rate, people won't be able to purchase things with salaries. So the decision would be for the Iranian regime to either kind of making the right decision, engaging in diplomatic, you know, opening with the West and settling for a deal, or facing the domestic pressure that has been building up.
You mentioned the UAE, which has already decided to cut economic ties with Iran. But what about the China element? Because without China changing its financial relationship with Iran, can this really be successful?
That's a really good question. And here's a very interesting development there. So with the U.S. naval blockade, a big portion of Iran's trade with China has already been disrupted, because really what that trade relationship is in the normal circumstances is Iranians would ship oil to China, the Chinese would purchase the oil, the revenue would be then used by Iranians in China to pay for import from China. Now, with the U.S. naval blockade, Iranians are not shipping oil. They're not importing any products. Now, they do have some oil that is sitting in international waters. These are the oil cargoes that Iran managed to ship out of the Strait of Hormuz before the U.S. naval blockade was put in place. That oil, you know, Chinese used to purchase about 1.5 to 2 million barrels a day. Now they're only buying about 500,000 barrels a day. There has been a 75% drop in Iran's trade with China already. So what makes UAE very important right now, and I would arguably say it would be more the UAE is more important than China when it comes to Iran's economic lifeline, is because UAE is Iran's gateway to formal and informal financial system outside Iran. And the naval blockade, it does not reach within the Persian Gulf. So Iran can continue to engage in trade with UAE through the Persian Gulf without a disruption from a U.S. naval blockade. And now UAE making the decision to cut those commercial relationships is going to put significant pressure on Iran's economy.
And what about the EU? If they don't take steps to match those sanctions, are we likely to see a repeat of diplomatic tensions that we saw earlier this year?
Well, I mean, it's really that Iran's remaining trade with EU, because remember, we had a snapback of EU sanctions last year in September. United Kingdom has imposed its own unilateral sanctions against Iran. So the level of formal trade with Europe is already at very low levels. Now, I've seen the case of EU and in UN and UK sanctions that have been financially effective. And by the way, EU just rolled out some sanctions against the Iranian regime. So those sanctions remain in place. And I think the Iranian trade with Europe is not nearly as high as its trade with UAE and China. And I think that's why US government is more focused on those commercial relationships with UAE and other Gulf states and China.
Miad Maleki, appreciate your time this morning. Thanks so much. Well, let's get the thoughts of Lise Doucette, our chief international correspondent. Lise, we know from much of your reporting that you've done in Iran how much the economic situation is biting for ordinary Iranians. But when you have a country where the leadership are frankly not bothered about what life is like for people who live there, can a return to an emphasis of sanctions instead of bombing actually have an impact?
Well, there's no denying that the people of Iran are suffering. During visits to Iran over the years, we were staggered to see the rate of inflation. Last year, it was 60%. We worry about single inflation here in the United Kingdom. After what has now been nearly 6 months of this on-again, off-again war with the United States, economists say it is, at points, it's running at around 82%. And when we were there last, young people were lamenting that millions of jobs had been, prices continued to spiral. They saw no way out, no future for themselves. And I remember leaving Iran thinking, how are they going to swirl? But on the other side, Iran is now the world's biggest expert on how to survive sanctions. I remember after the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine, Russian officials going to Iran about how to circumvent sanctions. There have been nearly five decades of sanctions, including what we've just been hearing about during President Trump's first term. It was called pressure. Now the new words are economic fury. Now, as of yesterday, it's Operation Economic Cast. They have not at the determination of the Iranian leadership who hold firm. And yet again, they are reaching out, accusing the United States of yet bombast. And let's be honest, there's been bombast in these last 6 months of again, off again war. But they also threatened to take revenge. And they've proven that they can and will do it on neighboring states, which have relations to the United States and to Israel. It's hard to see it will work. And quite frankly, and if you listen to Scott Bessent's announcement, it fell far short of what was expected. It was more a warning shot. And when he was asked, haven't they announced specific measures, what they're called secondary sanctions, against the countries still dealing with Iran, he said, why would I want to blow up the global financial system? He didn't mention the word China once. He didn't mention it in his op-ed in the Financial Times. Do you think they're going to aggressively after Chinese banks, the small Chinese refiners? Sold the teapot refineries, and before the first state visit of President Xi Jinping to Washington.
Thank you, Lise. Lise Doucette, our chief international correspondent, on what was a glitchy line there. So sorry about that.
20 past eight is the time. Let's talk more about housing now. The government's telling us this morning that councils in England are going to get the green light to build council homes, homes for rent, affordable homes, a 10-year plan, 70,000 new homes in those 10 years. And it's part of the wider plan that Keir Starmer had to build 300,000 social and affordable homes under his £39 billion building scheme. Let us talk to Matthew Pennycook, the Minister of State for Housing, who's on the line now. Morning to you.
Morning, Justin.
Why councils?
It's really important that councils get back in the game and are building at scale again, alongside housing associations and other providers, because council housing has a range of benefits. Democratically accountable, it allows local authorities to better tailor provision to local need, so they can bear down on things like rising temporary accommodation costs. So we think it has a role through the announcement we're making today, which is the first wave of funding being allocated from our £39 billion 10-year programme, that biggest increase in social and affordable housing funding in a generation. First wave, £9.5 billion outside of London to go to housing associations, providers and councils for the first time, who will receive long-term funding certainty so that we can increase delivery and get site going across the country.
Are the councils, though, ready to do this work? Because plenty of them haven't done for decades.
Well, I think it's be really clear what happened to council housing, because it's a really important part of the story. In 1953, councils delivered just under 200,000 homes a year. Council house building rates fell off a cliff in the 1980s as a result of the introduction of the right to buy scheme. We were down to about 1,000 council homes a year in 2013. We have done a lot as a government to reinvigorate council house building. We saw last year, 2024-25, the highest delivery of council homes since records first began in 1991-92, but we've got to do more. That's why we are making more of the funding available through our £39 billion social and affordable homes programme available to councils to get back to what the Prime Minister rightly wants to see, which is the biggest council house building drive since rates dropped off in the early 1980s.
But if you're getting back to the 1950s, in the 1950s when they were building those huge numbers, they presumably had the wherewithal to do it, the development teams, the expertise, etc., etc., and the fear now is that they don't.
Well, they don't in many places, and that's a result of the fact that council house building has run down.
So do you accept that they'll have to, for instance, get consultants in order to organise the business of actually putting these houses out? So the councils will be in charge, but the work will be done effectively, and they'll have to pay for it to be done by outsiders?
Well, I don't think that'll be the case in all circumstances. But let's be very clear, there are councils out there who are delivering lots of council homes as things stand. We are funding through the £9.5 billion we're allocating outside London in this first wave of funding, funding to three councils as long-term strategic partners, certainty over funding. We're holding back more for councils. But you're absolutely right, we've got to do more as a country to increase the skills and capability of councils to build. We've already got a programme that's doing that. We're refreshing that programme. We're giving it an extra £46 million as part of the announcement today to ensure that councils can get back in the game, learn from each other, increase their skills and capability to deliver more, alongside housing associations and other providers who continue to have an important role in the delivery of social and affordable homes for many years to come.
To what extent is the land already earmarked to do this?
So in many cases, when it comes to the funding that individual providers have bid for in this first wave of funding, they'll have already purchased the land, identified the sites. One of the criteria that Homes England, which scored the bids, asked providers to come forward with is how quickly can you deliver these homes? So we will see these homes being built in this spending review period. We'll see.
So spades in the ground when?
Spades in the ground will depend on every individual provider and the agreement it's made with Homes England. As I say, we'll see significant amounts of this £9.5 billion spent in this spending review period, homes built in this period. It's a 10-year programme, so the backstop we've got is that every home funded through this £39 billion programme has to be completed by 2039 at the end of that 10 years.
Yeah, which the Conservatives have drawn some attention to and said, actually, that's, if it is going to be completed at all, is likely to be towards the end. In other words, there is nothing much. Someone who's waiting on a council waiting list at the moment, this doesn't really mean much for them, at least in the short term.
No, I'd take issue with that. We've already allocated through bridge funding £2 billion for social and affordable housing. Those homes are being built and will be delivered as we speak. When I come back to, let's come back to the statistics, if you like. Last year, we delivered around 64,000 affordable homes, highest rate since 2014-15. As I said, we delivered the highest number of council homes since records first began in 1991-92. Is there more to do? Absolutely. But this government has put a huge emphasis on social and affordable homes programme. We've taken the amount of funding going to social rented homes, the most affordable homes, from the 19% delivered in the much smaller £11.5 billion programme under the previous government to over 60% of this £39 billion. We're getting the homes moving. This is just the first wave of funding. More but to come.
The thing is, you keep saying that. So, I mean, I'm just looking at a press release from the Starmer days from, this is actually 2024, so quite soon after the election. In a major boost for communities across the country, the government is today turbocharging growth with new mandatory targets for councils to ramp up house building across the country. There are a lot of targets, there are a lot of warm words, but I suppose it is reasonable, isn't it, to say, when do you actually get to the kind of numbers that would allow you to stick, for instance, to your target for house building across the piece before the next election?
But it's not just targets, it's not just warm words, it's actual funding. Funding is going out the door in this first wave allocated from that £39 billion programme. It will see homes delivered. If you put to me, as has been done before, I was on your show just last week, is it a challenging time for house builders across the country, including providers of social and affordable housing? Absolutely. We're seeing dampening demand for private market sale homes. We're seeing rising materials costs across the board. But I'd say that's why it's even more important that we get this counter-cyclical injection of grant funding from government into the system. It will help private market sites build out in many cases. So we are getting things moving. But that 1.5 million target, always been a really stretching target. We've got lots more to do to turn around the legacy and we inherited. But this initial wave of funding, with more to come, just to be clear, £16 billion of funding held back for future rounds outside London, where we'll prioritise social rented homes and council house building. This is all what is required to turn things around and get high and sustainable rates of house building.
A final thought about accountability, because not all councils are in Labour control and some councils might themselves have different ideas about where it's suitable to build and about the planning process and how reasonable it is to hold things up, etc. And they might in some circumstances be supported by local people in that. To what extent are you going to be able to hold to account councils that don't achieve the targets you've set them?
Well, look, we've been very clear that we think it's right that housing targets are in place. They play a really important role. You'll recall that the previous government abolished mandatory housing targets. That had a really detrimental effect for housing delivery. Part of the inheritance we picked up was that constrained supply pipeline as a result of that. We think targets are right. And we've been very clear that when it comes to housing delivery, whether it be private market sale or social and affordable homes, when local authorities need to decide, and it's absolutely right that they do, where those homes go, we are not, it's not up for debate that they need to build those homes and meet those targets. As I say, we've got an acute and entrenched housing crisis in this country. I come back as I had several points, questions put to me this morning. Why are we doing this? We've got over 1.3 million people on social housing waiting lists. I represent a South East London constituency. My borough has 29,000 people on its list. I have people in my advice surgeries doing homework on the end of their beds, kids in living rooms. We've got to do more. The funding we're getting out of the door today, including that renewed emphasis on council house building, is a first step. There's more funding to come as part of that historic £39 billion programme.
Matthew Pennicutt, Minister of State for Housing. Thank you.
It's 29 minutes past eight. It's time for the sports news. He's back. Hello.
Anna, thank you very much indeed. As sports continue to try and find new ways to increase engagement and profitability in an environment where attention and space is limited, two of the big nations in rugby union have decided to secure their future by turning back the clock. South Africa and New Zealand are the top two teams in the world, winners of the last four World Cups between them, and they're playing their first multi-test series since 1996. The All Blacks that year won a series in South Africa for the only time in their history, and they were captained by Sean Fitzpatrick, who joins us now from Cape Town, where the second test is this weekend. Sean, New Zealand won the first match on Saturday in Johannesburg. It was a bit of an upset that set the series up nicely.
Yeah, morning, Hugh. Very much so. You know, I've played in South Africa a number of times, and Ellis Park would have to be one of the most hostile environments to go to and try and get a win, playing at altitude and playing as the double world champion. So it's a massive win for the All Blacks, but I'm sure that we've poked the bear and we'll see a response from the South Africans in Cape Town.
They're calling it the greatest rivalry, Sean. Great can mean a lot of things, certainly in a context of marketing exercises, but these are the two best teams in the world right now looking particularly for meaningful matches.
Yeah, I think so, Hugh. You know, you look at the Nations Championship that we saw, you know, a couple of months ago, which is a new competition, which is meaningful games, basically. And it engaged the public, you know, every three Saturdays in a row in the UK from 8 o'clock in the morning till 8 o'clock at night. We had six games going on, which really engaged the public. They got the numbers were huge in terms of engagement. And that's what this tour is about. And I take my hat off to South Africa and New Zealand rugby unions for thinking of this. It was not an easy decision, obviously, to cancel the Southern Hemisphere Championship for a year, basically. Was not great for Argentina and Australia, but it's something we had to do in terms of engaging fans, having meaningful tours, meaningful games that excite people. And honestly, Hugh, the feeling down here, I haven't experienced anything like it. 30 years ago, it was pretty special. But the fan engagement here and the interest around the tour is just phenomenal. It's exactly what we need in terms of the state of world rugby.
I've heard it said it feels a lot like a Lions tour. It's got the same sort of rhythm to it. Multiple test matches, tour matches in between. In fact, the final tour match that New Zealand play will be tonight. And lots of travelling fans.
There's in terms of registered tours, there's over 1,500 have come on the tour for the whole tour, and then there's probably another 1,500 of independent people that are flying down, you know, for the test matches. So yes, it's been a huge success commercially, and you know, and in terms of the rugby also, as I said, the game at Ellis Park, just a wonderful environment.
There's a debate in many sports about trying to find space just for existing tournaments, let alone trying to resurrect something from the past. But these two teams have found some, at least, for their own benefit. But like you say, Australia and Argentina in particular will no doubt feel they have been maligned in this. How do you square that circle?
I think, you need to speak to the powers to be, but I think, you know, we're playing extra games against Australia in terms of the Bledisloe Cup, which we played after this, and Argentina have had other games. The Springboks went there a couple of weeks ago, so it's just, Hugh, everyone is not going to be pleased or happy with the situation that happens, you know, from time to time. But as I said at the start, we need to make these tough decisions because the game at the moment, in the terms of where it is going, it needs to be sustainable. And we need to engage fans. We need to engage the young fans like other sports are doing.
Just quickly, it is a four test series. Three of them take place in South Africa. The fourth is in Baltimore in the States. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to suggest to you that if it's 2-1 after the South African leg of the series, the other one doesn't really matter. You want the series, right?
No. Well, that was the case. Actually, in 1996, we played four tests in a row. And the first test was actually the last test of the Tri Nations. So, I don't think that'll be the case. And hence, Hugh, why they had the shield. I mean, the trophy is able to be cut in half. If it is a draw, you can take your half home.
They have planned for that. Sean, thank you very much indeed. Sean Fitzpatrick, the former New Zealand skipper, the last skipper to win a series in South Africa for the All Blacks.
Hugh, thank you. A word now from the writer and mental health academic, Nathan Filer.
Neurodivergent. Neurodiverse. Neurotypical. Words that barely existed in everyday conversation a generation ago, now they're everywhere. But what do they really mean?
My mum would have to explain, Matthew's got autism, Matthew's got ADHD. And that would be the cut and paste explanation of it.
I'm Nathan Filer. In a new series, I'm exploring one of the biggest shifts in how we understand human difference.
The label is not the important part.
All Kinds of Minds. Monday mornings at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Science.
It's 25 to 9. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb in London and Anna Foster in Salford. And Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
There's been a defiant response from Iran after the United States threatened to cut its economy off from the rest of the world. The Trump administration said fresh sanctions would target countries or organizations that continued to deal with Tehran. The Iranian finance minister said it was economic terrorism. Ministers have set out plans to spend £10 billion on building more than 70,000 social and affordable homes across England. Speaking to this programme, the Housing Minister, Matthew Pennycook, said the government wanted to reinvigorate council house building around the country. A judge in the United States has agreed to delay the trial of a Libyan man accused of building the bomb that blew up an American airliner over Lockerbie 37 years ago. The delay was requested by the suspect's defence team, which said new evidence had emerged in the case. A government-commissioned report has warned that young adults who leave care in England are 3 to 4 times more likely to die than other people their age. The Department for Education says it's increasing funding to provide better support to vulnerable care leavers.
Thank you for that. 24 minutes to nine is the time. What do we do about China? There is a growing feeling in the US academic community that we in the West are not really coming to terms with the new balance of power that sees China flexing its power around the world. The Chinese are helping Russia, as we know, in Ukraine. They're allies of Iran. They may well have had something to do with the recent cyber attack on a power station here. And at the same time, they're a growing economic power, and not just in cheap goods that we could decide not to import, but in essential basic industries increasingly, like the car industry. You may remember yesterday we spoke to Sir Richard Moore, the former head of MI6, and asked him about how the UK should be dealing with China.
You need a long-term, consistent approach to China, which both engages them on the big issues where we need to engage them, for example, safety of AI or climate change, and at the same time is very robust in pushing back when they are doing stuff which is against our interests. Look, there's no simple answer on China. You have to have a balanced, long-term approach that manages both to seize opportunities with them on trade and other things, but also manage any threats that they pose to us.
No simple answer indeed. Brad Setzer is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in the US and is talking now in the US about a China shock, a new China shock that the world is having to cope with, in which the political power around the world increases for China because of their economic power. In other words, if you seize the trade opportunities, there is a risk that you increase the threats as well. I've been talking to him and he told me how he got to this point.
Two things have happened and are continuing to happen. One is that after China's property bubble burst, which was in 2021, in the second year of the pandemic, China's domestic economy has really slowed. There just isn't a lot of demand growth happening inside China. And as a result, China has relied on the rest of the world to generate demand for its products. The second thing that's happened is that some of China's industrial policies have, in a sense, paid off. China spent a lot of money, provided a lot of subsidies, worked hard to create an electric vehicle industry. And Chinese banks financed a lot of different companies who are now have the capacity to produce a ton of electric vehicles. And as a result of that industrial policy success, China is taking market share in a number of key industrial sectors, sectors that are central to the modern European economy, sectors like autos, sectors like wind turbines. So that industrial overlap combined with the cost advantage from a weak currency, combined with a domestic economy that isn't really working, has just led to an explosion of Chinese exports in sectors that really matter to Europe.
In the first part of your answer, I was thinking from the point of view of a European consumer, what is there not to like about that? The cheaper cars, better cars potentially coming in and other goods as well. But I think in the second part, you were hinting at what then you think is potentially going to happen to us as a result of it.
Look, if everyone was a consumer living off inherited wealth, there would be nothing not to like. You're getting cheaper goods at a lower, you're getting higher quality goods. You're getting more competition. But the reality is most people in most economies have to earn their keep by selling their labor, by working. And so the downside is lost jobs, lost income in those sectors that compete directly with China. So, you know, there's always an equilibrium. And I think you have to think about the gains to consumers. Those are important. The cost of living does matter. But you also have to think about how you earn your living in the global economy and whether you're going to be getting those consumer gains at the cost of giving up industrial sectors that are the basis of your future prosperity.
And that future prosperity and those industrial sectors, if you do give them out, you're not just talking in economic terms, are you? You're talking about power, raw power.
I think what we have learned, certainly over the past 10 years, is that a country, a big country that controls key supply chains can weaponize that supply chain dominance, other countries' supply chain dependence, and more or less say, if you want access to our industrial might, if you want access to our refined rare earths, which go into electric cars, which go into wind turbines, if you want access to the critical minerals that often go into weapon systems, you have to treat us nicely. You have to respect us politically. And there's a sense that if China gains control over more supply chains, if there's not sufficient diversity in the global economy, that China would be in a position to use that for political leverage. And, you know, I think it's fair to acknowledge that the West writ large has also used its position in the semiconductor supply chain in ways that have restricted China's autonomy and have prompted China to want to weaponize its control of other choke points.
We talked on the program yesterday to a former head of MI6, the British Security Service, and what he suggested was that it should be possible to stand up to China where it was necessary, but also to cooperate with China, that it was possible to have that sort of dual relationship. How feasible is that, given what you've just explained about the changing power dynamic?
It's certainly possible. It gets more difficult. There is a simple reality that China's big, China's not going anywhere, and China's political system isn't changing. And all the other parts of the global economy, all the other great powers have to have some kind of relationship with China. At the same time, the economic relationship has to be somewhat, at least in my view, balanced. It can't just be we provide demand and China provides supply. And it's that unbalanced nature of trade and the risks that come with it that's kind of at the center of the second China shock.
What do we do then at a political level to come back to this tension that there is among politicians who want to be friendly with China, particularly actually in the wake of Donald Trump and the obvious difficulties there are dealing with him, but at the same time want to be able to preserve themselves, need to be able to preserve themselves?
There is no doubt that the lives of any prime minister or chancellor in Europe has been complicated by Donald Trump's desire to put tariffs not just on China, but tariffs on Europe and on the UK. At the same time, I don't think it is viable for countries with large automotive or mechanical engineering or chemical sectors to stay open to China as they are now, setting the US aside, if the trading relationship with China remains as unbalanced. So until, at least in my view, China's own economy evolves so that China can be a better trading partner, I don't think it is possible to remain open to China or as open to China as many countries are now. I don't think at least personally, the current level of dependence is something that should be sustained because it has this cost in terms of strategic autonomy. So I think there needs to be an evolution, but it is that evolution needs to happen without there being a complete rupture in the political relationship and the economic relationship with China. That's a hard balance.
Brad Setzer, thank you very much for talking to us.
It's 8:45 now. The trial of the man accused of building the bomb planted on Pan Am Flight 103, which exploded over Lockerbie in 1988, has been postponed for a third time, we're hearing this morning. The killing of 270 people, most of them on the plane, some of them on the ground below when the wreckage hit their homes, remains the worst act of mass murder in British history. And the search for justice for the families of those victims has been a long and complex one over over the last nearly four decades. David Cowan joins us, Scotland Home Affairs correspondent. And David, I think that's one of the biggest details of this story today. Another postponement of this trial is just another moment where those families are not seeing the justice they've waited so long for.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a story that started long before December the 21st, 1988, when Pan Am 103 was blown up over Lockerbie. And everything was set for the trial to get underway this week. Jury selection was supposed to begin tomorrow in the federal court in Washington, D.C. They were talking about opening speeches on Monday next week, evidence getting underway. Witnesses were going to be flying from the UK, from Scotland across there to give evidence. Former police officers, serving police officers, lawyers from Scotland were going to do too. Relatives from the States were getting ready to go to Washington for the trial. And now at the last minute, completely out of the blue for the third time, it's all off, probably until next year.
And they're saying, David, new evidence has come to light that's been the reason why this postponement has happened. Do we know any more detail than that?
Well, the man on trial, his name is Abu Agila Mohammed Masoud Kir Al-Marimi. He's alleged to be a member, former member of the Libyan Intelligence Service. And the case against him is that he built the bomb which destroyed Pan Am 103. It was planted on another flight in Malta, transferred onto another flight at Frankfurt, and then onto Pan Am 103 at Heathrow. The new evidence, we don't know what it is yet. It's under seal in the court in Washington. It's not been made public. We're playing a bit of a guessing game here, really. I think the judge in the federal court in Washington, D.C., has been trying to keep everything on track after two previous postponements. She's been trying to make sure as well that everything is fair for Al-Marimi. What the defence asked her to do was call the trial off because newly discovered evidence emerged about this 37-year-old case on Friday last week. This was something the defence and the prosecution didn't know about before. The defence said it had constitutional and ethical obligations to investigate this development, so it asked for the delay. And I think, you know, we can assume two things. It must be important because the judge wouldn't have called the trial off otherwise. She would have been very reluctant to do this. And I think it also must be something that strengthens the prosecution case because it's the defence that has asked for this delay.
And while it's obviously vital that the legal process is carried out the way it should be, and you've covered this story in detail, David, you know that because this happened so long ago now, 37 years, there are family members who fear that they may not survive to see this trial, and that in fact, when you look at the health of people involved, only one person ever convicted as part of this. Time really is of the essence for people, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a horrible pall of sadness over this entire story. There always has been. I mean, 270 victims, 259 passengers and crew on Pan Am 103. I think the youngest was a baby. There was an 82-year-old person who was killed as well. 11 people killed on the ground at Lockerbie when the plane fell out of the sky and destroyed their homes. You know, and amongst those passengers, for example, was a large group of students from the States who'd been over here on an exchange visit. I think 21 of them were 21. So their parents, 40 years later, are getting elderly. A lot of relatives have passed away already. And this march, this delay, pushing the trial into next year, means that more of them will no longer be clearly around to see that happening. So very frustrating for the relatives. Also, though, a recognition that something important must have come up. Otherwise, the judge wouldn't have done this.
David Cowan, BBC Scotland's Home Affairs correspondent. Thank you.
11 minutes to 9 is the time. What happens if the pressure for a journalist to get a scoop overtakes the obligation to tell the truth? Tracy Scott Wilson has a new play. It's called The Story. It explores exactly that, following a young hack so desperate for a front-page exclusive that she fabricates a complicated tale. In part, it's inspired by real events. It explores race, ambition and ethics in the newsroom. Nicola Stanbridge went along to rehearsals at London's National Theatre, where the play opens this week.
Rehearsing the gripping opening of The Story, the murder of a white teacher in a black neighbourhood.
What, we're lost again?
We're not.
Yes, we are. He sent a term right to Blunt.
They wanted to show their parents the area had changed.
They wanted to show their parents it wasn't so dangerous.
We are lost.
Playwright Tracy Scott Wilson and director Clint Dyer explore how The Story is reported by an ambitious young reporter.
A journalist who is writing about a very high-profile, contentious news story, and the repercussions of that in the community.
Yvonne is the young, hotshot journalist. Usually you take your time to move up the ranks. But Yvonne wants everything now in her own way.
Every time I bring a story back, Pat edits it to death. She says it's not positive enough.
Are you sure about your sources here? Girlfriend been in this town but 5 minutes. She's built no relationships, no trust, no sources, but she out here trying to be Woodburn and Bernstein.
In part inspired by Janet Cook's 1980 Washington Post story about an 8-year-old heroin addict she discovered, which shocked Washington, D.C., but wasn't all it seemed.
That was the inspiration for the story. Janet Cook was a reporter who wrote for the Washington Post in the 80s, and she won a Pulitzer Prize for a story that turned out to be fabricated. But it veers very far from that. She just came back to her editors and said that she found this kid that was a heroin addict. This is the beginning of the crack era. They went with it, and had she not won the Pulitzer, there's a good chance she wouldn't have gotten caught.
It led to changes in newsroom standards and this public apology from Janet Cook on ABC's Nightline.
Regardless of what happened to me at the Post or what sort of a situation I found at the Post, I can never offer that as an excuse for what I did. It was wrong. I shouldn't have done it. And certainly, for the rest of my life, I'm going to have to deal with people who are not going to believe a thing I say about practically anything.
This has been happening since the dawn of newspapers. It is always ends up sort of being a systemic failure of the paper for whatever reasons, culturally or politically.
Why is it relevant now, do you think?
We're in a time when everyone has the capability to be their own newspaper. And we always deliver the news via our own perspective. And this story is about who suffers from that.
The Yvonne character is an outrider. There are thousands of journalists from all different backgrounds who report faithfully.
As faithfully as they can. As faithfully as the outlet that they work for allows them to be. It will get edited by someone else, it will get talked about by someone else, it will be reported on by someone else, and the story becomes now, especially now, what the public decide it is.
The technology makes it faster, but this is nothing new. This is something that is built into human nature. This need to control the narrative, this need to embrace a narrative, this need to have power over the propaganda. This has always been happening.
Every idiot with a computer thinks that they are a reporter now, with their blogs filled with half-assed theories and gossip.
I don't know that an Yvonne or a Janet Cook, I don't know that that will ever stop. As long as people have the need for something to be tidy and to be explained and to be justified, there will be a larger entity that will jump on that and say, okay, I'm going to give you what you need in exchange for money, in exchange for power, in exchange for your attention.
We have to be very meticulous. Your job is to gather, disseminate, and verify information, nothing more.
That is the story, and it's running at the National Theatre in London from this Thursday until October the 24th. Now, after the news, David Dimbleby profiles a political advisor who some claim is more responsible than anyone else for America's decision to invade Iraq. That is Invisible Hands, the American Century, continues at 9 o'clock this morning here on Radio 4.
Time now is 6 minutes to nine. People living in the city of Bath who have big cars, and there will be plenty of you listening right now, are from today having to pay more to the council to park on the street. Bath and North East Somerset are affected, but of course other councils are going to be watching very closely and may well follow suit quite soon. Maria McCarthy is on the line, the motoring journalist, and Ginny Buckley as well, who's the founder and editor-in-chief of electrifying.com, which is a website that's all about EVs and helps you choose them. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Maria, you think it's a good idea?
Well, I think it's got a lot of positives. I mean, anybody who's ever driven in Bath will know that it's got narrow streets, it's got a lot of traffic.
And most of them closed too, it's worth saying.
Yes, and when you do have these big vehicles, they can obstruct people, they can make it difficult for cyclists. So I can totally see where the whole idea is coming from.
Right, so you see it as an effort to persuade people either not to drive at all, or if they do drive, to drive a smaller car.
Exactly. I think it's quite interesting about the whole sort of smaller car issue because, you know, cars have grown, you know, hugely, you know, back in like the 1970s, say, the VW Golf hatchback was, you know, 18 centimetres narrower and 26 centimetres shorter than they are now. You know, cars have just got bigger and bigger. And of course, people always feel that they need bigger cars because, you know, they need to fit their children into them. They need to fit their sports kit and so forth. And sometimes that's absolutely true. You know, sometimes they just do have, you know, families and lifestyles that require a larger vehicle. But there are some people as well who might be able to be perfectly happy with a smaller vehicle. So it's just about, you know, making them think about, you know, perhaps that's the direction they should be going in.
Ginny Buckley, size not the right thing to be thinking about because size is so much of our ability to live with cars, and the smaller they are, the easier they are to live with.
It is, but this policy actually isn't doing that. The council's stated objective is to encourage smaller, safer, cleaner cars. But what they're doing is simply multiplying a vehicle's length by its width, and that's a very blunt instrument. So I'm not sure this policy is targeting the issue that intelligently. So they've repeatedly used the growth in the popularity of the SUV to justify it. Yet Bath's own examples of cars caught up in these extra charges include the Renault Clio, the VW Golf, family cars like the Vauxhall Zafira, the seven-seat Ford Galaxy. We're not talking about huge £100,000, you know, massive Range Rovers here. You know, if you've got kids and you've got car seats and dogs and elderly parents or mobility equipment, you might genuinely need a larger family car. And of course, a VW Golf isn't that big a car. So I don't think it's reasonable to characterise the people who drive these cars as making environmentally responsible or less safe choices.
What do you think the distinction should be, if indeed there should be one, if they are going to go down this road, what should they be saying?
I think you have to not conflate the three. If you want to tackle pollution, you measure pollution. And indeed, Bath has been very successful doing that. If you want to tackle road space, then you measure size. If you want to tackle safety, you use the evidence around safety. But you can't conflate the three. And that's what this is doing. I think one of the really interesting things for me on the safety subject is the Tesla Model Y. So an electric car, great for the environment. One of the larger family EVs definitely takes up more road space. But that doesn't make it dirty. And the size alone doesn't tell us whether it's safe. So the Model Y has got a 5-star Euro NCAP rating. It scored 92% for safety assist, 86% for vulnerable road users. It's got tech that detects pedestrians and cyclists. It alerts you when you're opening your door if a cyclist is passing. So this kind of safety tech is becoming fundamental to modern vehicle design. It's playing into making cars larger, as increasingly as advanced crash protection. So I just don't accept that the length multiplied by the width of a car can tell us if it's
safe. It's an interesting point, that, isn't it, Maria McCarthy? That actually larger cars can be safer cars, not just safer for the people in them, but safer for pedestrians as well. So the council, in a sense, is maybe going down a rather old-fashioned route.
I think that's a really interesting point. There's an organisation called Thatcham Research that researches vehicles. They're so interesting. When you go onto their website, you can see the various pedestrian protection systems that are available, where they'll send a car like bombing down a highway, and then they'll send a little sort of model child out, and it will pull up because of things like, you know, automatic emergency braking. And I think that you can go onto the website of Euro NCAP, for example, and find out which cars have the best pedestrian safety record, as well as looking at the safety record for occupants within the vehicle. And I think that's very much a route that we should be going down, is looking at pedestrian safety.
Right. Okay. Well, if